Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
North Carolina.
The ruling stands. North Carolina's strict voter ID law is unconstitutional. The U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear an appeal challenging a lower court ruling that found the law racially discriminatory. The lower court said the Republican-led legislature targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision. The legal fight is over. The GOP voter ID law is dead. WUNC Capitol Bureau Chief Jeff DeBerry joins me now to talk about the latest. Welcome back, Jeff.
Hello, Frank.
All right, so remind us what that 2013 voter ID law did.
It came days after the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, struck down part of the Federal Voting Rights Act. And in the law that was enacted by Republican lawmakers here in North Carolina, it did several significant things. There were notable and controversial provisions. It mandated photo identification. It reduced the amount of early voting time from 17 down to 10 days. It eliminated altogether same-day registration and out-of-precinct balloting, as well as eliminating pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds. Plaintiffs sued. They said that those were changes that disproportionately burdened and affected African-American and Latino voters. So it first went to a trial, one judge at the federal level, district court in Winston-Salem. Judge Thomas Schroeder, a nominee of President George W. Bush, ruled that the law was constitutional, said that plaintiffs, the NAACP, the ACLU, among, I believe, five, including the Department of Justice, Schroeder ruled that it was a constitutional law and that the plaintiffs had not demonstrated there were any clear issues of discrimination or evidence that showed why this law needed to be overturned. Plaintiffs then took their case to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond. A three-judge panel there ruled that it was unconstitutional and, as you noted, said that the provisions targeted African Americans with surgical-like precision.
Yeah, there were five main points in that in the law that they target. They said absolutely showed that this was a racially discriminatory law, right?
They did. Yes.
And they also that the legislature and the governor at that time had failed to identify even a single individual who had ever been charged with committing in-person voter fraud in North Carolina. In other words, there was no problem. And then when we see how these particular provisions targeted African Americans and disproportionately hurt them, it does start to build a case for an intentional act to disenfranchise African American voters.
Yes, and one note, perhaps a bit tangential, is that there have been few but some incidents of voter fraud found when we think about mail-in and absentee balloting, and that is not something that was included under this very controversial law 4 years ago.
Supreme Court refused to hear the case. Why?
That's not entirely clear, and that's the practice of the Supreme Court. They don't say exactly why they are not taking this, but Justice John Roberts, Chief Justice, indicated that some of this has to do with the blizzard of filings, his word, blizzard, and the many different folks who are trying to join and be party to this case and others. Remember that Pat McCrory was a defendant on this case. He was the governor. He's been unseated, and now Governor Roy Cooper wanted to withdraw from this case. So it's unclear, reading Roberts' statement today, if this his concern, it appears, is that, you know, was this case even before them legitimately, appropriately? So they have decided not to hear the appeal. They have not ruled on the merits of the case. They're not saying that this law is terrible or that this law is acceptable and can be worked around. They're, just to be clear, they haven't ruled on that.
Right. So here we are now. There is a nine-person Supreme Court with a majority, we would assume, conservative, given the fact that the last appointee was a Trump nomination. And that court has refused to hear this case. What are they saying in legal circles about what that means and how to interpret that?
So what the Fourth Circuit ruled last summer is now it establishes precedent. So if the General Assembly came back in tomorrow and tried to enact something similar, the plaintiffs would fairly simply go to a court and say, hey, they can't do this. Here's the Fourth Circuit ruling, and it would be null and void. So will there be another workaround from state Republican lawmakers? I would surmise I think there will be. But exactly under what terms and when and how, that remains to be seen. This was a big law. This was a big election law with some very substantial provisions. And conventional wisdom, and I chatted with a couple of different attorneys today, is that there are other challenges pertaining to voter ID that are more narrow in scope. There's one in Texas, there's one in Wisconsin, and as you think about how the Supreme Court tends to move on these things incrementally, by and large, it seems more likely to some of the legal folks I chatted with today that it would be more likely for them to take a case that is more narrow in scope than North Carolina's law, which was really a huge motherload.
All right, Jeff, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Talk to you soon.
Jeff DeBerry, WUNC Capital Bureau Chief.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
South King County has become a hub for immigrants and refugees. It's because it's more affordable than Seattle. But more people are starting to move there, and those high Seattle rents are starting to follow them. And that's adding to the pressure of life in South King County. Carolyn Adolph of KUOW's Region of Boom team reports.
On a street corner in a place called Skyway, there's a young woman working a food stand.
I've seen it all. I've seen people leave. I've seen people come.
This is Jordan Bolton, and she lives near here.
We're on 129th Street and MLK. You can get everything almost here.
We're in a chunk of unincorporated King County between Tukwila and Renton.
We have tacos and we have barbecue, so you can get some food up here. That's where I work at. I work at LT's Famous Barbecue. And then we have Tent City right in the back of us.
Skyway is a place where people of modest means try to get or keep a foothold. It's also a giant melting pot. Jordan Bolton.
I can't say there's one race. There's so many people we'll have, from Asians to Mexicans to white, black. Everybody comes and buys the food. If you don't have the exact amount of money, we will work something out with you.
She says Skyway will take you whether you're on the way up or down the ladder.
It's a place where people can come if they have nowhere to go. And Skyway will open their arms. Even whatever you have in your past, we will wipe kind of like a new slate.
Skyway isn't the only place where this is happening. Lots of people are coming south to start over. People with lower incomes are leaving Seattle. They're heading to South King County, to places like Kent, Renton, and Auburn, in search of something affordable. Especially people of color, particularly African Americans, who had been living in neighborhoods that are now highly sought after by people with money.
When people lose their homes in Seattle, they're pushed out or bought out, or rents are going so high.
This is Gwen Allen Karsten. She's a community activist and a business owner in Kent. She's been watching as African Americans from Seattle move to Kent in search of an affordable life. At first, she says, things go well. But parts of South King County are seeing bigger rent increases than in Seattle. So a few months down the road,
you go to work and you come home and you find a note on your door telling you your rent's going to be raised and there's nothing you can do about it.
Karsten is a member of the Kent Black Action Commission, and her hair care shop is a center of black life in Kent. But affordable housing is in short supply.
We have multiple families living in places right now because they cannot find separate places for themselves.
Because there's been less building there. So people keep pushing south.
Some people are going out as far as Pacific, Algona. Some people are even venturing out to Sumner. You know, so how much further can we push people without bringing a remedy to all of this, the high rent, the escalating in costs?
Belinda Derrick works for Karsten. She says her friends and relatives are considering a new destination.
It seems like Tacoma's cheaper now. With then you have apartment. To drive.
Yeah, I mean, the drive is a lot, but the apartment's cheaper, the living.
I accidentally made a map one time.
This is Tim Thomas. He's a doctoral student in sociology at the University of Washington. And he's been digging deep into census data.
What I found is that there's this massive shift of African Americans in Seattle moving away from where opportunity or higher income areas are.
Thomas says high rents have been driving people out of neighborhoods where their families and friends have lived for decades, places they were driven to originally by housing policies that targeted African Americans. Now they're being forced to move on. Thomas's maps show a strong trend of poor people heading south from Seattle in 2010, and that trend is stronger in 2015.
You see the migration of race as well as the migration of poverty. This massive shift of African Americans moving south, that's a big story.
There are fewer places to be displaced to.
This is Nathan Phillips of the YMCA. We're driving along the border between Tukwila and SeaTac. He stops at an old converted motel.
This is Birchcrest Apartments, across the street from Trailer Park here.
One of the few places left to go when you've been pushed out.
Your household income goes down by $50 a month. That might be enough to displace you to kind of one rung down on the housing ladder, which is sometimes old converted motels, mobile home parks, or for some families, even homelessness. There's not a lot of room left. At the bottom of the ladder.
One look at the Birchcrest, and you see people trying to make it feel like home. The tree out front is decorated in Easter eggs. People have barbecues outside for cooking. But being this close to the edge in South King County is stressful. Nathan Phillips.
If you look at life expectancy in King County, our most affluent communities now have life expectancies in the 90s, approaching hundreds. And in our lower income communities, we have life expectancies in some communities in South King County that are still in the high 60s. The place you live shouldn't be the determiner of how long you live.
Phillips says people need opportunities to get on the ladder heading up. That's something Jordan Bolton is making happen herself. She's partway through year up, 6 months of learning coder skills, 6 months of internship, like a boot camp for tech.
It's a rough 6 months, and then, I don't know, I haven't got to the internship yet.
She says she's seen people find jobs and leave the homeless encampment. Immigrants coming in and moving on.
Whether I move anywhere or any place, I'm not going to be able to change myself if I can't change myself here. So
that opportunity to renew yourself, that's something Jordan Bolton says can still happen. In South King County, I'm Carolyn Adolph. KUOW News.
Black babies cost less.
And here's the latest example of NPR's investigative reporting. America is the most dangerous place in the developed world to have a baby. Not just for infant mortality either, for the mother. Women here are three times more likely to die in childbirth than women in Canada and six times more likely than in Scandinavia. ProPublica's Nina Martin and Renee Montaigne, the longtime Morning Edition host, now a special correspondent for Morning Edition, teamed up for a six-month-long investigation on maternal mortality in the United States, and they're here to talk about their findings. Renee, thanks for coming on with us. Hi, nice to hear you again.
Yes, nice to be here.
And Nina, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here.
So, Nina, every year in the U.S., you report 700 to 900 women die from pregnancy or childbirth-related causes, and some 65,000 nearly die. Are those surprising numbers to you?
They are. I think most people think of maternal deaths as being a thing of the past, sort of, you know, Downton Abbey, Sybil dying in childbirth, that we're done with that. And I think most people don't know anything at all about the near deaths, the and near deaths are thought to be about, the CDC says, you know, for every death in the U.S., there are 100 women who nearly die. Those are pretty, and they mean really nearly die, not just mild complications. Those are pretty staggering numbers.
So, Renee, what are some of the main causes of death or near death in childbirth?
Well, there are several causes, some rare, some not so rare. One is preeclampsia, which leads to hypertension, high blood pressure, of a sort that can be fatal if not stopped earlier. There's hemorrhage, and that is one of the most common, if not in some groups the most common. There are cardiac issues, cardiac arrest at different stages, and also postpartum, and that's a really important new thing that the medical community is starting to look at. There are infections, sepsis. And, you know, some of these, you know, I found interesting that so many of these, and preeclampsia being one, mentioned Downton Abbey, that's what Sybil died from back in 1920. These are complications that have been around for forever. They're in the literature, they're in history, they show up, you know, as you know, childbirth deaths. And yet the United States has not got a handle on some of these that have every reason never to happen, almost never to happen. For instance, in the preeclampsia, that is a complication that Great Britain has pretty much solved. Two women in 2 years as a death.
Right.
Oh, not as a complication, but as a death. And we're talking about women dying here. It's pretty much solved. Whereas in the United States, there's a percentage. There's a percentage of women, and it's more in the dozens, but it is way farther higher than in Great Britain, and probably not. Maybe none of them should have died.
Nina, why?
Well, one of the big issues around preeclampsia in particular is, and hemorrhage fits into this category, another big one are blood clots, is preventability. So there's been some recent research from the CDC Foundation showing that in the states that they examined, they did analyses in four states, this is broader than this, and also California has done analyses, et cetera, that something like that the most preventable causes of death in the U.S. are hemorrhage, preeclampsia, and blood clots. I should say that the most preventable pregnancy-related deaths are caused by these conditions. And the problem is that in the U.S., you know, these are conditions that doctors and nurses and providers and hospitals and midwives and many, you know, people in the U.S. know how to treat as well as they do in Britain. But there's, you know, there's a real fragmentation of the healthcare system here. There's a lot of different ways that OBGYNs and nurses and hospitals practice. There's basically a real lack of standardization in terms of what you should do when you encounter a medical emergency. And a big issue is that because maternal deaths are, you know, a lot rarer than infant deaths, first of all, we focus, hospitals and providers are sort of have been really focusing their attention around maternal, around safety in the what they call the perinatal period. So really more on the infant, you know, the very vulnerable infant than the mother. And part of that is because there's this real perception that, you know, that maternal deaths are rare, and that the mom is, you know, pretty much always going to be fine. It's the baby that's going to have the problems. And so what you have happened is that a lot of providers they're just not prepared for emergencies. The emergencies are rare, and when they happen, they can go downhill really fast. And you know, you're supposed to be ideally you'd want your providers to be prepared for the rare event, just like you want airlines to be prepared for the rare, you know, the possibility of a crash. But in the U.S., around maternal care, they have not been prepared. And I would say this also goes both for – this is also an issue that not just for affluent women, obviously, like Lauren, but also, you know, African-American women and women of color. This is kind of across-the-board problem.
So, Nina, let me stay with you for a minute. Would that difference – of unpreparedness at hospitals, maternity wards in the United States, being worse than in Canada, being worse than in Scandinavia, other developed countries, be for a systemic reason? Is it something about the funding mechanisms here, the way we pay for healthcare? Or if you're saying the problem is, or one of the big problems is, that our medical institutions are not prepared for pregnancy and childbirth emergencies, why would that be different here?
I would say that it is a systemic reason, or I should say reasons. I think they're really complicated, and it's one of the – that's part of why we're doing this project, is we really want to try to tease them out. I think that, you know, we have a very fragmented healthcare system. We don't pay very close attention to patients from the beginning to the end. A lot of women don't get healthcare, very good healthcare. They get – you know, people always think about prenatal care, but a lot of, but women in this in the U.S. are more likely to have good, you know, decent or at least access to prenatal care than they are to have access to postpartum care. And postpartum care, we know from the recent data, is at postpartum. Many of these deaths occur in the postpartum period, especially deaths involving cardiac issues and also mental health issues, which are really important to. Include in all of this. So there's that. There's, you know, just a lack of standardization. I mean, if you think about it, there's, you know, thousands of hospitals that deliver babies in the U.S. and care for pregnant, care for new mothers. And all of them are, you know, some of them belong to systems and chains, but they basically all operate separately. We don't have national standards. We also don't have a national sort of systemic analysis or national or state sort of analyses of deaths when they occur, maternal deaths when they recur. They don't have to be, you know, reported to any particular organization. So basically what you have is a system where people, you know, the system is really fragmented. And then, of course, we have a population that is getting older, that's getting heavier, that's getting having more pre-existing chronic conditions going into pregnancy, which makes pregnancy much more difficult to manage. And so you have all of these things happening at the same time. And so and then when a death occurs, it's hidden. It's these women are lost.
Gus T. Renegade, I just wanted to point out in that segment, the most important factor in that, I just posted a documentary film about the astronomically high rate of maternal mortality rates for Black mothers. They do not point out in explaining why the maternal mortality rate is so high in the United States in comparison to other, when they say industrial countries, what they mean, in my view, predominantly white countries, areas of the world that have mostly white people. Why the maternal mortality rate is so high, in my view, is because there are so many Black people here. I've presented that same logic when I've talked about just any sort of public services, why we don't have universal health care here, which directly impacts maternal mortality rates. I said it's because there are a substantially higher number of Black people than, if you want to think about Canada, France, England, a substantially higher number of Black people, and whites are not about to offer phenomenal services for Negroes here so that Black females can be healthy and have rear great healthy Black children. But I thought that was really important. In fact, a white person wrote a whole book about how the welfare system in the United States is really, really bad and has been for decades because of racism, specifically because, exactly what I said, high number of Black people, we don't want to have good services for the Negroes. Continuing.
Moving out your neighborhood, but I walk through the ghetto, and the flavor's good, little kids jumping on me, but you want to be white and corny, living way out, nigga go home, spray painted on your house.
A new study suggests that African Americans can lower their blood pressure by moving to more racially mixed neighborhoods. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein has more on this research published today in JAMA Internal Medicine.
African Americans are more likely than whites to get high blood pressure, which is a big-time cause of heart attacks and strokes. So Kiari Kershaw of Northwestern University decided to test a theory.
Does moving from a highly segregated neighborhood to a less segregated neighborhood result in a lowering of your blood pressure? That was the main interesting, exciting question that we wanted to answer.
So Kershaw's team followed more than 2,000 African Americans living in Birmingham, Chicago, Minneapolis, and Oakland, starting in 1985 when they were 18 to 30 years old, to see what happened to those who moved to more integrated places.
We saw that their blood pressures dropped.
A lot. Their systolic blood pressure, the first number you get when you go to the doctor, fell by 1 to 5 points.
I think it's pretty powerful in the sense that the reasons for their moves were not necessarily for their health, but it has these other added benefits.
Now, the drop in blood pressure may sound small, but Kershaw says it's easily enough to translate into thousands of fewer heart attacks and strokes. The study couldn't pinpoint why getting away from segregation may help someone's blood pressure, but Kershaw has some ideas.
There's a decent-sized body of evidence relating stress to blood pressure, and that's one pathway that we hypothesize that segregation influences health through exposure to violence, things like that, that could increase your stress level and then potentially influence blood pressure.
And Kershaw thinks it's probably not just being exposed to less violence in their new, more racially diverse neighborhoods.
It's possible that they were exposed to neighborhoods with more economic investment and prospects for their children, access to better schools. These moves could result in improvements in their housing values, which could also improve their outlook.
And they could have easier access to things that help them live healthier lives, like sidewalks, parks, gyms, grocery stores with fresh produce, or pharmacies to buy blood pressure drugs.
And the take-home message is that policies that can allow people who are living in segregated neighborhoods to move has some spillover effects that influences health, like blood pressure.
Other experts agree. David Goff is a heart disease expert at the National Institutes of Health.
The big message here is that this study shines a light on one of the root causes of heart disease and stroke in our country. This tells us that there's something going on there that we need to understand better and we need to address if we hope to reduce the risk of heart disease and stroke, and especially reduce that risk in the populations with the highest risk for heart disease and stroke.
Maybe segregated places could be improved to reduce blood pressure by doing things like building more parks and better grocery stores. But Ashish Jha of the Harvard Chan School of Public Health says the biggest thing that could be done would be to eliminate segregation.
This study is really important because it helps us really feel much more confident that there is something about segregation itself that's leading to worse health outcomes. And this study says that we really do have to tackle segregation if we're going to really improve the health of minorities in America.
Rob Stein, NPR News.
As your body grows bigger, your mind must flower. It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
It's Schoolhouse Rockin', a chip off the block.
This is the day in 1954 that the Supreme Court issued its famous ruling desegregating schools, Brown versus Board of Education. Today, schools remain largely segregated, and the author Richard Rothstein argues that's because housing is segregated. Even today, black and white people generally don't live in the same neighborhoods. Rothstein's new book is called The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So the basic argument of your book is that while racist individuals might have contributed to housing segregation in specific cases, there was an overwhelming amount of government policy at the state, local, and federal level that explicitly forced black people to live in different places from white people. And I have to admit that reading this book, the geographic scope, the longevity, the sheer creativity of these policies really took me by surprise.
It takes many people by surprise. This whole history has been forgotten. It used to be well known. There was nothing hidden about it. The federal government pursued two important policies in the mid-20th century that segregated metropolitan areas. One was the first civilian public housing program, which frequently demolished integrated neighborhoods in order to create segregated public housing. The second program that the federal government pursued was to subsidize the development of suburbs on a condition that they be only sold to white families and that the homes in those suburbs had deeds that prohibited resale to African Americans. These two policies worked together to segregate metropolitan areas in ways that they otherwise would never have been segregated.
The book gives so many different examples of how this played out, and one of the worst offenders is the FHA, the Federal Housing Administration. Explain why this one government agency has so much influence over where people live and what the FHA did to prevent black people from buying and owning homes.
Perhaps the best known example is Levittown, just east of New York City, but there were subdivisions like this all over the country. What the federal government did in the 1940s and 50s, it came to a developer like Levitt, the Levitt family that built Levittown. That family could never have assembled the capital necessary to build 17,000 homes on its own. What the federal government did, the FHA, is guarantee bank loans for construction and development to Levittown on condition that no homes be sold to African Americans and that every home have a clause in its deed prohibiting resale to African Americans.
The FHA policies here were not merely incentives or encouragements. You tell the story of progressive, idealistic developers who wanted to build integrated housing communities and were absolutely unable to do so. And we're not just talking about in the Deep South here.
We're not talking about the Deep South at all. We're talking of the North, the West, the Midwest. The great American novelist Wallace Stegner got a job right after World War II at Stanford University. There was an enormous civilian housing shortage. He joined and helped to lead a cooperative of 400 families who bought a large tract outside Stanford University where they wanted to build single-family homes. The FHA refused to insure those homes, refused to provide the capital for construction because the 400-member cooperative had three African-American members. The cooperative tried to resist the FHA's demand, promising the FHA that the number of African Americans in the cooperative wouldn't exceed the percentage of African Americans in California as a whole. The FHA refused that compromise. Finally, the cooperative had to disband because they couldn't go ahead with the project. They sold the land to a private developer who, with FHA guarantees, built single-family homes with racially exclusive deeds.
Your book also explains one way in which black neighborhoods became undesirable. You describe zoning laws in which black parts of town were officially zoned for industrial plants, waste disposal, other things that we would consider a blight. And meanwhile, those businesses were explicitly kept out of white neighborhoods in the same cities.
Yes, there are examples in St. Louis and Los Angeles. Neighborhoods that once they had African-American residents were rezoned to permit industrial and toxic uses. Those rezonings turned those neighborhoods into slums. White families outside those neighborhoods looked upon the neighborhoods, saw slums, and concluded that African-Americans were slum dwellers and that they moved into their neighborhoods, into the white neighborhoods, they would bring those conditions with them.
Why were all of these policies put in place? Was it just overt racism on the part of policymakers? What actually was the motivation?
Well, that's very hard to know. And one thing that should be remembered is that it can't be blamed simply on the standards of the time because there were people who dissented. People did know better, but they had other priorities and they caved in to a private prejudice in some of their constituents. They themselves were prejudiced. It was assumptions about racial superiority, but it also was cowardice in not confronting popular views about racial superiority.
So as you lay out this history, these segregationist, discriminatory, harmful structures were built over the first half of the 20th century. And then Congress passes the Fair Housing Act in 1968, which says many of those practices were illegal, unconstitutional, and they stop, for the most part, the worst ones. Why doesn't that solve the problem?
Well, because all the Fair Housing Act could do was prohibit future discrimination. But by the time the Fair Housing Act was passed, the patterns of segregation had been firmly established. Simply passing a Fair Housing Act did not enable African Americans who were previously living in urban areas to relocate to the suburbs from which they'd been excluded. I gave the example earlier of Levittown. In 1947-48, when those homes were built with a racially restrictive policy, those homes sold for about $8,000 apiece or $100,000, more or less, in today's currency. African Americans, working class families, could have bought those homes. Today, though, those homes sell for $300,000, $400,000. They're no longer affordable to working class families. In the ensuing two generations, the white families who moved into those homes gained that $200,000, $300,000 in equity appreciation. African Americans living in rented apartments, prohibited from moving to the suburbs, gained none of that appreciation. The result is that today, nationwide, African American incomes on average are about 60% of white incomes. But African American wealth is about 5 to 7% of white wealth. That enormous difference is almost entirely attributable to unconstitutional federal housing policy practiced in the mid-20th century.
The current Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Ben Carson, has criticized what he calls social engineering programs that are meant to help black homeowners or renters. It sounds as though you're arguing that the first two-thirds of the 20th century were social engineering to harm black people in home ownership, and that maybe it will require some social engineering to undo that harm.
Yes. What I tell Secretary Carson is that the reforms that he's criticizing are an attempt to undo social engineering. Clearly, he's right that when you try to engineer social policy the way that is necessary to reverse segregation, there are some unintended consequences. There will be prices to be paid. But those prices are small compared to the costs of the social engineering that was conducted in the first two-thirds of the 20th century by the federal government. And it's a price that we have to pay to rectify a serious constitutional violation.
Richard Rothstein is with the Economic Policy Institute and the Thurgood Marshall Institute of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. His new book is The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Why haven't you learned anything?
The racist flyer that's making the rounds right now in the Lewiston Porter School District in Niagara County. It endorses two candidates for school board ahead of the election set for next week. But both of these candidates tell 7 Eyewitness News reporter Josh Bazan today they had absolutely nothing to do with this.
I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe what was written on the paper. I was just disgusted.
Lewiston Porter Superintendent Paul Casari is talking about this flyer that he says first started circulating the school community Thursday. It calls to keep Lewport white and says the effort to keep blacks out of your community begins by keeping them out of the classroom.
It's not what we are about. It's 180 degrees from who we are. We embrace diversity. We celebrate tolerance.
The disturbing flyer endorses two candidates for Lewport School Board, Betty Vandenbosch Warwick and Sarah Rote Wechter. Both say reading their names on the propaganda came as a shock.
Caught off guard by the fact that anything had been delivered. And of course, the first thing that you absolutely feel is you have a big sinking feeling in your gut.
Lewiston police are investigating and say there's no connection to different racially charged flyers that circulated the area in March.
This seems to be more of a focused effort to either defame or to bring some discredit to these people that are involved more than an ideology that's trying to be spread.
That is the most disgusting thing I've ever read. It kills me that that's been put out in our community, that anyone in our community would think that way. I really don't believe anyone in our community thinks that way.
And of course, it would be something that I would absolutely not want that endorsement because it goes against everything that I am and everything that I believe in.
The district and both candidates are considering legal action if they find out who distributed these flyers. In Lewiston, Josh Bazan, 7 Eyewitness News.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Disturbing video has gone viral and involves local high school students.
It shows a Coronado student screaming racial slurs at another student on a bus. Fox 5's Kathleen Jacob is live outside Coronado High School. She talked to kids and parents there. Kathleen.
Christine, John, the school is taking racism very seriously. Tomorrow, Coronado High is actually holding a symposium to discuss this incident and racism as a whole. Today, I talked to parents and students, and after seeing this video, they're glad that this is being addressed.
He is black and he makes himself look like a
and he try to act like
wow.
That's the video that has everyone riled up. Today I talked to dozens of students and all of them except for one person had not seen it yet. So it quickly made its way around social media. Out of the ones that had seen this, all reacted with disappointment and disgust.
It kind of hurt seeing that was getting around and people are going to think badly of us now because of that.
I just saw it and it was just like so vulgar and I didn't, but then again, I don't know what happened before, what to cause her to say that, or happened after.
I was disgusted by it.
Students I talked to are glad about tomorrow's symposium. They say it's something that needs to be addressed, and they all share a little responsibility in making this community a better, more tolerant place. As for the students in the video, we asked the school district what happened to them, if there's any punishment, any suspensions. They said that they could not comment specifically on suspensions because of student privacy. Reporting live, Kathleen Jacob, Fox 5 News, local Las Vegas.
All right, Kathleen, thank you.
But if I was white, then I'd be better off. Isn't that true?
More than 100,000 public school students in North Carolina missed out on classroom time in 2015 and 2016 because of suspensions. And when you add it up, these students missed more than 1 million days from their suspensions alone. And a new report out today shows the number of short-term suspensions for students is on the rise. Ricky Watson Jr. is co-director of the Youth Justice Project of the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. They assembled the report, and Ricky is with us now. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us more. Your organization went through some numbers that had been released earlier by the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction, and you were looking for some bigger trends. What are some of the big trends that you found as you sifted through these numbers?
So essentially, some of the biggest trends that we noticed is that from about the 2007-2008 school year to about 2013-2014 school year, suspension numbers were down. Those numbers were down, for example, in 2007 at their highest. They were at about 308,000 for short-term suspensions.
And what? Forgive me for interrupting. What is a short-term?
A short-term suspension is essentially a suspension that's less than 10 days.
Okay.
That actually has some implications for due process rights that a young person is entitled to. If it's a under 10-day suspension, they don't necessarily have to have a hearing. But if it's over 10 days and it's a long-term suspension, then they're guaranteed some of those rights that allow them to have a hearing and opportunity to be heard.
All right. So you saw it. So there was a decline. It begins in 2007. It goes through 2013. And then the trend changes.
That's right. What we've seen is that those numbers are back up with the 2015-2016 school year. As you stated, and the big takeaway from this report is that 100,000 students in North Carolina missed over a million combined days of classroom instruction as a result of suspensions in the 2015-2016 school year.
And the increase is in those short-term suspensions, right?
That's correct.
And in fact, the long-term suspensions from 10 days to expulsion, have they declined a little bit?
Those numbers have consistently declined since the 2007-2008 school year. But, you know, the concern is that those numbers will also start to creep back up.
And you've noticed a disparity in who gets suspended, right?
Yes. Unfortunately, the types of students that we're seeing that are most directly impacted and affected by these numbers, it's disproportionately male students, African-American students, and students with disabilities. They're suspended and expelled from North Carolina schools at a disproportionate rate, and it's consistent with the same children that we see are most likely to get involved in the school-to-prison pipeline and end up in juvenile and adult court.
What are the, to give us a sense of the ratios or how out of whack this is?
So black students make up over half of all suspensions in North Carolina, despite making up only about 25% of the student population here in North Carolina.
All right. So what's going on there?
There are a lot of different reasons. You know, the increase now, we believe there are a variety of different reasons, like implicit bias, a lack of teachers with experience and resources to address behavior, also, a lack of minority teachers in the classroom. There's actually a study that was just released by Johns Hopkins University that found that low-income black students, if they had just one black teacher in grades 3 through 5, were more likely to graduate. Mm. That's a powerful number, and that's a very new study that came out just this month. But there are a lot of different reasons as to why we're seeing
this. Well, you talk about the resources, too. One of the things that's happened, while we've seen a teacher pay in the last couple of years increase, the fact is that per pupil spending is just about flat, and in some ways you could say even less than it was before 2008 when you consider the increase in the number of students. So we're spending less per student, meaning that teachers have just a harder time in the classroom managing everything.
Absolutely, and I think it's important to preface and state that, you know, we fully support public schools and we want to do what we can to help improve them, and none of this report is meant to be an attack on public schools, but we also understand that North Carolina public schools are under attack right now. We also understand there's a lack of resources in public schools. When you see budget amendments being passed at 3 o'clock in in the morning that are targeting spending on education. It's concerning and it's devastating to public education. We're talking about children. We're talking about young people. And we're talking about making sure that, you know, schools and children are never a bipartisan issue.
Can you understand a partisan issue? Can you give us a sense of how that would play out in terms of discipline and suspensions? I mean, again, the idea that somehow the increase in the number of suspensions could be linked to shrinking per capita spending or per pupil spending that we've seen over the last 7 years in the state of North Carolina, pulling back money out of the school system. Why would that have an impact on suspensions?
Well, think about it. How do you address and how do you handle issues if you don't have the resources to, you know, adequately address them? We understand and know that teachers need training. They need alternatives to suspension. They need policy changes. They need interventions that are positive. And if they don't have resources and funding to do that, it's going to make it really hard to be in a classroom and teach and educate.
All right. And you talked, too, about the experience and trying to keep experienced teachers and all of that. Part of it is pay, but also, again, the other resources, class size is going to make a difference.
Absolutely.
Textbooks are going to make a difference. And if you cut funding for textbooks and if you cut funding for resources and if you cut funding for art and other activities that help explore a child's total being, this is going to have an impact on a teacher's desire to stay in a system. What about the link? You mentioned it earlier, this link between suspensions and contact with our penal system.
Yeah, so that really refers to a bigger problem of the school-to-prison pipeline. So essentially that's a vicious cycle that starts with a youth kind of getting into trouble in school. Unfortunately, oftentimes that punishment will consist of some combination of being suspended and then expelled from school and a loss of class time, essentially. That's often also accompanied with some form of referral to a court system, whether that be juvenile or adult. Missing class time results in academic failure and an inability to really catch up. And unfortunately, we happen to be in a state like North Carolina, which is the only state left in the country that automatically prosecutes 16-year-olds as adults in the criminal system.
And it's a pretty clear correlation, I should say, between the number of days you've been suspended, the amount of time you spend out of school, and the likelihood that you're going to find yourself before a judge before your 20th birthday.
Absolutely. Unsupervised children are unserved children, right? So when you're out of school, you're not receiving that valuable instruction time that makes you want to be in school. It makes you want to learn. We need to start figuring out and identifying some alternatives to suspension.
All right. You talked about, again, we'll take a look at some of the disproportions here and the disparities. African-American students, you talked about who's teaching in those schools, implicit bias, which has been demonstrated over and over again in our school system. And when it's, interestingly enough, in those school systems that have taken it seriously, they found ways to address implicit bias. Teachers and administrators have been grateful for learning this and moving forward and coming out with better numbers. Implicit bias, who's in the classroom? What are some other reasons? And also, you talked about students with disabilities. Why are they disproportionately suspended? What's happening there?
Well, unfortunately, those same students with disabilities are the same ones that we're seeing being referred to court systems as well. I think that bigger picture and generally, you know, we saw a decrease in these numbers for suspensions and expulsions due to a growing public consensus that suspensions weren't effective and that they didn't work and that there was an increased understanding of the harm that was caused by suspensions and pressure by advocates at the local level. I think that when people started to notice those numbers dipping, they kind of got comfortable. And unfortunately, I think that's why we're back in this position where we're seeing those numbers creep back up.
But what about long-term suspensions? Why do you think those numbers continue to decline?
I think that, unfortunately, there is the aspect of due process being a concern, right? So we talk about the difference between short-term and long-term suspensions. And for long-term suspensions, you're entitled to have a hearing as a student. That means you're given due process and the ability to kind of have a hearing and discuss and talk about exactly why that student may or may not need to be suspended. Under short-term suspensions, that doesn't happen.
So it's just an easier thing to do. You can do that for 10 days, and there might be multiple suspensions for one student.
Absolutely.
Over a period
absolutely.
Of time.
So we talk about that 1 million number, and we're talking about only 100,000 of those students. So essentially, they have been suspended multiple times.
Because, again, if most of them, a number of them are 10 days or less, you can do the math.
Oh, now you were one lucky nigger.
You better listen to your boss, white boy.
Oh, I'm going to go walking in the moonlight with you.
You want to hold my hand?
Good evening and thanks for joining us. I'm Carla Castillo.
And I'm Rusty Surrett. A Texas A&M professor says his life has been threatened. For the first time today, Dr. Tommy Curry has released public statements about his controversial comments that he made during a podcast interview almost 5 years ago. And in that interview, he made reference to an actor's comments about, quote, killing white people. Since then, there have been calls for the professor's resignation, but others have stepped in to say that his comments have been taken out of context.
Context.
Looking at behavior in context.
Dr. Curry has declined to speak with us on camera, but he did agree to answer some questions that were emailed to him by News 3's Jessica Grunling. Jessica?
Dr. Tommy Curry says after his comments went viral this week, he's been receiving death threats. In a Facebook post today, Curry said he's been threatened to be lynched and mutilated by white supremacists. He did tell me that all of those threats have been turned over to the authorities. Earlier this week, Texas A&M President Michael Young released a letter to the student body that called Curry's comments disturbing. But Curry says he has not heard from the president or any administrator since all this has happened. He went on to say, I believe that Young's letter has firmly demonstrated where he and many Aggies get their news. The only venue suggesting that I am advocating violence are websites run by known white supremacists and felons. Some people have called for Curry's job. He said he has no intention of resigning or believing his tenure is in jeopardy as of yet. We asked Curry a number of questions. We are posting all of his answers unedited to this story online at KBTX.com.
Carry me back to old Virginia. There's where the cotton and the corn and taters grow. There's where the birds warble sweet in the springtime. There's where the old darkest heart am long to go. There's where I labored so hard for old massa. After day in a field of yellow corn, no place on earth do I love more sincerely than old Virginia, the state where I was born.
New tonight at 6:30, the mayor of Charlottesville is responding after a large group of protesters gathered at Lee Park last night. The group is protesting the decision to remove Confederate monuments from the city. Well, the crowd held up torches as they stood near the statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. Our sister station in Charlottesville reports people were heard chanting, "You will not replace us, Russia is our friend, and blood and soil." The crowd broke up after a fight and police arrived at the scene. Mayor Mike Singer released this statement that reads in part, "This event involving torches at night in Lee Park was either profoundly ignorant or was designed to instill fear in our minority populations in a way that harkens back to the days of the KKK. So he went on to say, "Either way, as mayor of this city, I want everyone to know this. We reject this intimidation. We are a welcoming city, but such intolerance is not welcome here." The protest comes ahead of Monday's city council meeting, where councilors are expected to decide the remaining recommendations from the Blue Ribbon Commission.
In the past month, New Orleans has removed a couple different statues that celebrated moments of the Confederacy on the grounds that we need not have such edifices in order to remember our racist history. And over the weekend in Charlottesville, we learned exactly why keeping these things around is harmful. A group of white nationalists, aka supremacists, gathered in front of a Robert E. Lee statue Saturday night chanting, "You will not replace us," and "Russia is our friend." Then, in a moment channeling some of the darkest times this nation has ever seen, they gathered after dark with lit torches in a stand of solidarity. If you've seen the images, it is frightening. Yeah, we don't need demonstrations that resemble the KKK rallies in order to properly remember what was once a truly horrendous place. If it's about heritage, not hate, why go straight to the tactics of those who push the latter? Maybe because that premise is a crock of nonsense to begin with. I'm Clinton Yates, and that's my take.
There's where this old darkest heart am long to go.
Mia Abu-Jamal joins us today by phone from the SCI Mahoney State Prison in Frackville, Pennsylvania. He has published 7 books in prison, including his searing and best-selling Live from Death Row, which Dick Gregory says single-handedly brought dignity to the whole death row. His voice is a continuum of the black prophetic fire of David Walker, Nat Turner, Frederick Douglass, W.E.B. Du Bois, Paul Robeson, and Malcolm X. So, Mumia, I want to ask you about this neo-slave narrative that you write about on Live on Death Row, from Death Row, and how black radicals like you who counter that narrative, why it's so incendiary to the state.
What's necessary for the state is the illusion of normality, regularity. So, you know, think about this. In Rome, what the emperors needed was bread and circuses. In America, what we need is housewives of Atlanta. We need sports. And we need, these moral stories of good cops and evil people. And because you have that, because you really have, what you know perfectly, having read your books, you know that, you know, there is no critical thinking in the United States in this period. You have emotion, right? And if I can get you to look at someone who's demonized, then I can do anything. I can do anything. And that's how the state works, by demonizing people and then putting them in places where they're virtually invisible.
You write in the book about how that this kind of neo-slave narrative, it sells because it gives the false illusion that there's somehow escape from the system, that no one is absolutely guilty, nor the oppressed, the slave, the prisoner, absolutely guiltless.
Right, exactly. And here's the reality. America has never come to grips with what a lot of scholars and thinkers call its original sin. And that's because it never stopped happening. Think about this. This country that, brags about being founded on freedom was founded on slavery, was founded on Holocaust, was founded on genocide. And after slavery ended, after the Constitution was rewritten and amended, and we had the Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, well, what did the South do? They ignored it for a century. You know, there were a few bright years, Reconstruction, and then there was Redemption, where that was destroyed. And it isn't until the 60s that you see this deep, rich emergence of people fighting for rights that were enshrined in the Constitution a century before. That's because every state in the South and many states in the North were allowed to make exceptions to the Constitution. Those exceptions when it came to black people. And we've learned that that's not just the Southern reality. You can't talk about AEDPA, the so-called anti-terrorism death penalty, unless you have the same mindset that makes the Constitution an exceptional document. Only
this is a call from Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Mahanoy.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
That's what we have. And we have the same thing with a different name.
In 1968, I think it was, when George Wallace was running for president, he held a rally in Philadelphia, and you were 14 at the time. You attended that rally with three of your friends, and it was right out of a Trump reality, a Trump rally. Can you explain what took place?
We had the illusion of freedom. So this was our city. We were born and raised there. We went down to what's called the Spectrum. And, you know, like, it sounds silly now, but, you know, imagine five or six, you know, young teenage boys shouting black power in the middle of a Wallace for president.
Okay, I'm not going to let you stop there, because you were also shouting Ungawa.
Ungawa, black power. It sounded, you know, rhythmic. It sounded sexy.
Right. Well, you said we didn't know what it meant, but it had a hell of a ring to it.
Yeah, it sounded good. I mean, I still don't know what it means, but, you know, it sounded good. Well, people began spitting at us. People began ripping flags from their sticks and throwing sticks at us and just, you know, just hollering at us and shouting at us. Well, some police came and other security, and they escorted us out, and we thought, hey, well, you know, we had a little fun, and we, you know, our voices were heard, and we went to the bus stop, and two or three of us were on the bus, a young guy named Alvin and a guy named Eddie, and I was like, I'm usually the slowest, so I was behind them. a guy walked up and hit me with a blackjack and knocked me down and pulled Eddie and pulled Alvin off the buses, and we were getting our asses kicked. It never dawned on us that these were cops, because you can't just walk up and beat people up. Well, I remember seeing a cop's leg walk by, and I said, "Help, help, police." And the guy looked at me, looked down at me, and he walked over and he kicked me right in the face. Then it dawned on me that all of these guys were cops. And that was a little taste of Rizzo, a little taste of Philadelphia, and an introduction to Trump. We see it today. I mean, I can hear Trump saying, you know, yeah, beat the hell out of them. In the old days, well, I lived in those days. They weren't good days. They were ugly days, and they're ugly days today. Listen, I'm on another brother's time. Chris, I got to go. I love you all.
Mumia.
It's great to hear your voice. All right. On the move, y'all.
You're an inspiration to us all.
As are you, sir.
New York, New York.
New York could become the first state to use a device being called a textilizer, like a breathalyzer, only it would test phones at crash sites, not to see content, but just to see if a driver used the phone just before the accident. Other states are also considering the devices, but as we'll hear, there are concerns about drivers' rights. Let's bring in Ben Lieberman. He's been working on developing the textilizer with an Israeli company while New York considers using it. Ben's 19-year-old son, Evan, was killed 6 years ago, a passenger in a car that crashed while the driver was texting. He joins us by Skype. And Ben, terrible loss. So sorry.
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that. Yeah. Means a lot.
And you know that the driver was texting because you had to launch a lawsuit and spend months in court to find that out.
Yeah, it was a difficult process. After any kind of crash, there's always some sort of a suit to get a hold of the different insurance proceeds. And I wouldn't settle the case until I got a hold of the cell phone records.
Yeah. But you had to get warrants and such to do that. What are you talking about with the law that New York is considering and this device? What would it do?
Well, what the law would do would allow police to use technology that we've developed that would allow the police to, at the scene of a crash, to be able to determine whether somebody was actively using the device illegally. That's a key area that's missing right now.
Well, people are very surprised when they hear this. They think there's laws against texting and driving. So naturally, if you're stopped or if an officer sees you, thinks you're texting, you can be pulled over. But what? Can you not just take someone's phone now?
Yeah, that's the biggest misconception that's out there. And I'm not going to say that I didn't have the same misconception. You know, I learned the hard way. When you hear so much about distracted driving and how bad it is and how prevalent it is, you would assume that common sense is dictating that this is going on. But it's absolutely not. And you know, when I speak at schools, I bring up a statistic from 2014 where there were 258,000 crashes in the year 2014. And I'm talking about New York State. And I asked the crowd, how many of those do you think were reported as texting and driving? And the answers I get are anywhere from a third to a half. And the answer is shocking because the answer is only 64 people. And that's because while a police officer could see somebody texting while they're driving, when it comes to a crash, they can't do anything about it unless there's an eyewitness or an unlikely confession.
Or like you, somebody goes and gets warrants to get access to the contents of a phone. Look, why not just rely on that? You know there are concerns that this device, although the device maker says that it will not collect data at all, it will only show that the phone's been used, and then that gives the police or the courts the right to go and get a warrant. But since there are concerns about privacy rights, why not just stay with the current system of getting the warrants and going through the courts?
Phone records are completely obsolete right now for the problem that exists. Sending a simple email, which is a very likely candidate for a distracted driving crash, that doesn't show up in a phone record, nor does social media and all the activity that's going on Facebook and Snapchat and that, browsing the web, app use, Pokemon Go, taking selfies. That's not showing up in phone records anyway.
So you're saying what your device would do is enable people to see the phone was used.
It's going to capture typing and swiping. And it could also determine illegal typing and swiping versus legal Bluetooth and voice activation. So the idea is to have an efficient but very respectful investigation.
That's Ben Lieberman. His son was killed by a driver who was texting. And Ben now co-runs an organization called DORCS. It stands for Distracted Operators Risk Casualties. They've come up with a device. New York State is considering a law that would allow the use of that device. Ben, thank you so much. We're going to stay with this. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, let's just bring in for a couple of minutes Donna Lieberman, no relation. She's executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. And Donna, we know that the union and others are objecting to this notion that somebody might be able to get data from phones. But Ben swears that that will not happen. It will just show usage and you can later go for a warrant to see more. What's wrong with that?
Well, you know, what this legislation would do is require all drivers to turn over their cell phones when asked by an officer at the scene of a traffic accident and at risk of losing your license for a year and incurring a fine. That means that people who have done absolutely nothing wrong, have not engaged in distracted driving, will be subject to punishment.
But if these things become like breathalyzers, we know what they are. It's a textilizer. And all it's doing is showing if there's usage at the moment or up to the crash. Isn't that worth the few seconds that you might have sitting in the car there if you know you didn't use
Well, first of all, the technology that is being mandated and assumed exists has actually never been field tested, and there's actually never been any showing that it is so limited. But the information that is sought is readily available to the police or to a litigant based on a warrant or a subpoena. So why go around the warrant requirement with an invasion of privacy when it's not necessary? Nothing about this law will do what we really want to have done, which is to stop distracted driving. We have to adopt measures that don't just feel good to us, but that are effective in reducing the incidence of distracted driving.
That's Donna Lieberman, executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. We will continue following both sides of this debate. Donna, thank you.
Thank you.
This is why I've always wanted to be a cop, so I can criminalize the gate in your stroll, the shade in your mold, and take a toll. A displaced dark face as safe as an ace in a hole for a cop. As good as I, a book of guy for drinking crooked eye. Don't resist a pudding pie. You think I won't, but why wouldn't I? I'm a cop.
Over the last few years, many white police officers have shot unarmed black victims and wound up in the news or in court. In Tulsa yesterday, one of those officers was acquitted. Tulsa police officer Betty Shelby was on trial for fatally shooting 40-year-old Terrence Crutcher back in September. Matt Trotter of member station KWGS was at the courthouse and joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, Ari.
Remind us of the circumstances surrounding the shooting.
So Shelby came across Terrence Crutcher with his SUV stalled in the middle of a Tulsa street. She was trying to figure out what was going on there. She noticed that Crutcher was acting strangely, and she believed maybe he was under the influence of PCP. She gave him orders to get on the ground. He wouldn't comply with those. Instead, he walked away from her with his hands in the air while she had a gun pointed at him. And Shelby says when Crutcher reached inside his car window for what she believed was a gun, she shot him.
What was the case that the defense made for why the officer killed Crutcher?
The case they made was Shelby believed Terrence Crutcher was reaching into his car to get a gun. Now, no weapon was found, but what the defense told the jury is that Shelby's training is basically she needs to act instead of react. That if she waits too long and waits to see a gun before shooting, she could be dead.
Is the police department reevaluating that training?
Not that I'm aware of.
We have some reaction tape from Crutcher's father, the Reverend Joey Crutcher, speaking outside of the courtroom. Let's listen to this.
Let it be known that I believe in my heart that Betty Shelby got away with murder. And I don't know.
Matt Trotter, does that reflect a larger sentiment within the community?
I think it depends on who you ask. Betty Shelby certainly had her own group of supporters. You know, they stood outside the courthouse with I Stand With Betty banners and were in the courtroom with wristbands and stuff. But yes, there is a significant part of Tulsa that believes Betty Shelby should have been convicted.
The mayor gave a news conference saying that he respected the jury's decision, but the racial divide in Tulsa needs to be addressed. What does he mean by that?
Well, Mayor G.T. Bynum basically ran on a platform saying that he recognized a racial disparity in a lot of areas of Tulsa, from a life expectancy gap between the north parts of Tulsa where more black people live and the south parts where more affluent white people live, transportation, other sorts of services. So he's launched several initiatives or tried to launch several initiatives to help fix some of that.
He is white, we should say.
He is white, yes. And today's news conference was an acknowledgement that those efforts need to continue.
Do you expect this is the end, or what happens from here?
Well, there's no further action that's been announced from the family, either embarking on going after those police department reforms or a civil suit. I haven't heard anything about further protests as of now. The police chief also announced during today's news conference with the mayor that they're evaluating Betty Shelby's status with the Tulsa Police Department. It's not certain that she's going to come back. That's a decision that's going to be made, he said, in the near future, but a specific timeline hasn't been given.
Matt Trotter of member station KWGS in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Mama says police mistreat black people.
Is it true?
Is that true?
Parents of a black teenage boy killed in a police-involved shooting in Texas want the officer to be held accountable. Former Balch Springs police officer Roy Oliver, who is white, is charged with murder. He is accused of shooting and killing 15-year-old Jordan Edwards in April as the teenager left a party. The Justice Department has also launched an investigation. The Edwards family spoke to our Omar Villafranca in their first television interview. Omar's outside the Balch Springs Police Department. Omar, good morning.
Good morning. Charmaine and Odell Edwards say their son Jordan was an honor student. He loved football and had a bright future. It has been almost 3 weeks since the incident, but Charmaine has not gone back to church because that would require her to drive by the spot where her son was killed.
I go in his room and I'm waiting on him to walk through the door, like to have my laughs, for him to say, bye, I'm gone. It's like, it's never gonna happen.
For Charmaine and Odell Edwards, the death of their 15-year-old son, Jordan, does not seem real.
I have his pictures now throughout the house and on my phone.
You saved the pictures on your phone?
Yes. Yes. Every day I look at the pictures. And I just wish I could see them.
According to the arrest warrant for Balch Springs police officer Roy Oliver, on April 29th, he shot and killed the teenager outside a house party. Jordan, his two brothers, and two friends were driving away in a car. Oliver allegedly fired multiple shots into the sedan after unsuccessfully trying to get them to stop. A bullet struck Jordan in the head as he sat in the front passenger seat next to his 16-year-old stepbrother, Vidal.
You're in the car. Have you replayed that moment in your head?
Every night. Can't even sleep.
What do you do to kind of just breathe?
I pray.
What do you pray for?
Peace in my heart and get rid of my anger.
Their oldest brother, Kevon, was in the back seat when he saw Jordan slumped over.
You're 17. What goes through your mind when you see your brother?
I was angry. I didn't expect for it to be him.
I do have questions.
Balch Springs Police Chief Jonathan Haber said body camera footage of the incident revealed police behavior that didn't measure up to the department's core values. Oliver was fired on May 2nd, and 3 days later, after an investigation by the Dallas County Sheriff's Office, he was charged with murder.
If the car was leaving the scene and wasn't posing a threat to anyone, why shoot? But you literally shooting like you playing target practice. That's in my mind, that's what it's like he was hunting. You use rifles to kill animals. That's what you do. And that's what he did.
Following Jordan's shooting, the boys pulled over for help and were confronted by officers who detained them. Before being handcuffed, Vidal says an officer called him the N-word and he worried he'd be shot.
I thought that was running through my head. Like I'm not going to be able to say goodbye to my parents or my brother that I have.
Did you have the same thoughts as Vidal?
Yes.
In a statement, the Balch Springs Police Department told CBS News they've reviewed many hours from officers' body cameras and in-car cameras and have not heard any of the officers use the N-word to describe the boys. The Edwards say they want meaningful change, which for them means seeing Oliver locked up.
What would you tell Roy Oliver about Jordan?
You killed an innocent kid that loved life, that would have made you even smile if you knew him.
The family says they don't believe all cops are bad, but they say that cops who break the law need to be held accountable. As for Oliver, he posted his bail and was released, but he has not spoken publicly. Nora?
All right, Omar, thanks. This is such a disturbing story, and I feel for that family.
I do, too. I mean, listen, nobody believes that all police officers are bad, but it's very difficult when you look at that video. It's another example of why it's good to have the video to get the whole story and put it in context. But it's heartbreaking to hear. I didn't realize that his brothers were in the car either, which makes it also very painful to me.
Yeah, traumatic for them.
Context of white supremacy. I had an opportunity to hear that final clip a second time where they were talking about the shooting of Jordan Edwards, where the white female announcer at the very end, when she said, such a disturbing family, I mean, disturbing event, and I didn't know his stepbrother was right there and all that. That I think sometimes they might refer to that sort of thing as a Freudian slip. I think that might have just been her dedication to the system of white supremacy coming through, because white people in general, that's how they, what they think about black people. These niggers. I'm sorry. I'm supposed to act like I'm concerned that this teen was shot. Yes. Context of white supremacy, compensatory call in. And she said, they said context at the end of that segment as well. Context of white supremacy, compensatory call in. If you have commentary you would like to share, things that happened over the last 7 days, counter racist suggestions, views, feel free, chime in. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. A couple quick things before we get to the callers. For one, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Address again, racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested 8+ years of us broadcasting, all because listeners have supported us. I hope the program has been, continues to be, worthy of your time and energy. Thanks to all the folks who supported, got us things from the Amazon wish list as well. I'm wearing my slippers right now. They are fantastic. Right on. A couple quick items to point out. Number one, Pam should be here. We had to reschedule twice. I have sent her at least 5 threatening emails. If we have to do any more rescheduling, I will be making an unplanned visit to Illinois. And it's summertime now. I've told Pam repeatedly I do not do cold weather. And every time that I've been to Chicago, I've never been in the wintertime. Every time I've been to Chicago, it's been spring or summer. It's been cold every time. So I can only go to Chicago for like May through August. So I can come right now and get at Pam if she stands us up or messes around. But she says she's clearing out her calendar and she will be here. We are ready to roll this coming Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Looking forward to chatting with one of our favorite guests to have her back on the program. It has been too long since we have heard from her. Things I wanted to point out from the clips really quick. The segment, this is on NPR, and I think some of our listeners saw this report from this week. I guess just, I've stated consistently, the system of racism, white supremacy, they are master deceivers. So you have lots of lies. It's very difficult to ascertain what is true. In the system of white supremacy, you have to do some thinking. You have to be adept at critical analysis. So on one hand, You have one piece of information that says that leaving a quote-unquote segregated neighborhood and going to a quote-unquote more diverse neighborhood, whatever that means. They didn't give quite enough detail, but going from one to the other is supposed to be better for black people. Somehow I think they might mean if black people move to an area where there are a higher number of white people and or a higher number of non-black people, the services might be better, schools, amenities, less crime, all the things that they mentioned within that segment. So you have that bit of information on one hand, which could be true. That makes logical sense. If you move to an area where there are a higher number of white people, you might be less likely to have a Flint situation, maybe. But we also have Dr. Darren Smith, who said that just being in the presence of whites is bad for the health of black people. So you have to, you know, come to your own conclusion. United Independent. The next thing, when Clinton Yates, who is a black journalist, he writes for The Washington Post, and then he does his audio commentary that I play sometimes. I played the segment today. He was talking about what happened in Charlottesville, Virginia, my alma mater, University of Virginia. He said, hearkening back to the darkest times, talking about these whites, Richard Spencer, Spencer was out there leading the charge in Charlottesville about the Confederate monuments. And I thought that's in the word, guy, to watch the use of, you know, dark is always associated with something vile and evil and wretched. And I thought, no, hearken back to the whitest times. That's what I mean about, I don't have a problem with the use of the term white. It just makes sure we're using the term correctly. When you use the term correctly. Next up, the segment where the Chris Hedges, the white man who interviewed, suspected race soldier who interviewed Mumia Abu-Jamal, and he, in his open, he referenced Dick Gregory saying that Mumia's work Live from Death Row, which I have read, that work gave dignity to death row. And I was reminded of Dick Gregory, who's been on this program. I was reminded of Mr. Fuller's commentary about dignity and, you know, what's the difference between a dignified slave and one who is silly. I'm sure folks have heard him bring that up many times. I was reminded also of Jamie, one of our listeners who's also in the Washington, D.C. area. She's called in many times, primarily workplace racism. She said she always appreciates hearing from Mumia, but she commented about the disruption when he was trying to speak. They would just interrupt and come in, and this is the Pennsylvania Correctional Facility, and blah, 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 just total disruption of being able to give out quality information done purposely for. And then you think about the extraordinary number of black people who are in greater confinement, continuation of enslaving black people, the number of black people who have to deal with that sort of interruption and, you know, the little bit of time that they have to talk to, you know, family members, children, people that care about them. I also, in that segment from prison, no less, Mumia, he said, I'm on someone else's time. He had to end abruptly because he was, in quotes, on someone else's time from prison. And again, just, wow, it stood out as profound for many reasons. Last thing I'll get in. I think on this program, a number of times we've talked about when we've had white guests and they snicker at something, they find something, they just, you know, start laughing while we're discussing the system of white supremacy. And in that segment, Chris Hedges, suspected race soldier, talking to Mumia, he asked him about this protest and this term that they used. I don't even want to say it, but I don't want to say it because he said he didn't know what it meant. But Mumia remembered this phrase and he said, sounded good, don't know what it means. And Chris Hedges, oh, he was just cackling. Man, I thought that is his white supremacy coming through explicitly in that very moment, just with the laughter. And I think people who listen to this program, man, that's something that you should really pay attention to when you're talking with a white person about a serious matter and they start laughing, particularly if nothing is funny or did I make a joke? You know, what's going on? Like, oh, wait a minute. Let's really pay attention to see what's going on here. But I thought that was so critical, and particularly, again, on this program. That's why I don't do metaphors on this compensatory call-in any Saturday. We don't do metaphors because words are so important. Whites like Chris Hedges will continue to cackle at us as long as we do not understand the importance of words. You do not use terms, especially when we're talking about the business of counter racism. You do not use terms just because they sound good, or I enjoy saying them, or because they are rhythmic. That is child. That's why racist man, racist woman, racist child. Man, they will be laughing at us for a long time. No threat at all, as long as that's the way that we think in using words, particularly about racism. You want to have explicit definitions that make logical sense. Again, compensatory call-in, no metaphors. That is a part of the problem in terms of us not understanding the astronomical significance of words and definitions. Racists, they will use metaphors. That's a big part of how they deceive us. They will compare things, make analogies, similes, where they're comparing things that are not equivalent at all. They do this regularly, and I submit it is a deliberate act of white supremacy. Non-white people, we pick up a lot of their behavior patterns. We are still learning. Gus T. Renegade, first and foremost. Many times when we are attempting to convey a concept or an idea, we will employ a metaphor, hoping that that will accurately convey our thoughts. Often the metaphors, they do not. They just add confusion. And again, frequently things are being compared that are not equivalent. Let's just make sure that we're being explicit, direct, clear about what it is we want to say. I will prompt about the metaphors. With that, if you have commentary, line should be open for the first few folks who dialed in. The number one more time, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. We'll be here tomorrow. I forgot. Global Sunday Talk on Racism, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. We should have lots of folks from different parts of the globe to converse with us. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Thomas in New York. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you too, Gus. Good evening. I had a few comments to make on the clips. First, Amita said, I'm on another brother's time, and I felt that that was kind of strange, because you certainly are on brother's time, and goes back to you saying, don't use brother, definitely. The high blood pressure clip, I found it was odd, because I know for sure that seems like blacks that live in areas controlled by white people have the highest high blood pressure in the world. Say in Africa, the only people with the highest blood pressure that have abnormally high blood pressure, people who live in South Africa. And then you come to the United States, you know, black people have the highest blood pressure. I think only second to the Aboriginal Australians, and they're under the same sort of conditioning that we are under. Just the tidbit, I was before the basketball game came on at night, they were talking to the Australian black basketball player, Patty Mills, and he was the whole story about how his mother, who was had a black mother and a white father, was snatched away from her black mother and forced to live with a white family and white foster homes so she could be assimilated into whiteness. And that's just to show, you know, one of the reasons why our blood pressure is so high when we live amongst white people. Watched the Charles Barkley race program, and it was pretty good, and it kind of fit into the clip. Yeah, it kind of fit into the clip where they were talking about the disparity and how they set up the living conditions for blacks and put whites in certain areas and wouldn't allow blacks to come back in them. And he did a lot of good work on that show on redlining in Baltimore. And, I mean, it was pretty pretty distinctive how he laid it out. And I thought it was very good, especially coming from someone as confused as him. And that's playing out today, a part of that clip where they say they put some of the most harmful stuff in the black areas. Here in New York, they want to knock down Rikers Island and build small prisons inside of small jails into the black areas. And a lot of people are going to say how that's going to you know, bring down the living conditions in the black area. And they've already started doing that with the shelters. And around the corner from me, in an area that's pretty being pretty regentrified, on a major thoroughfare on 145th Street, they built a shelter. And I mean, that whole area has just come down. It's like just keep putting the harmful things in the black neighborhoods. The cop that was got away with shooting, with murdering the man. I just found it hard to believe how they could, she could think someone was reaching in a car when he was walking toward her with his hands up. It just was very odd. It just shows how the system works. They just, you know, always criminalize us. The last thing I wanted to touch on was the father of these three basketball players. His name's LeVar Ball. He's been in the news a lot. And I think that what he's doing is black self-respect, which is why are so out for him. Instead of signing a deal with Nike or Reebok or someone, he started his own sneaker company. And he'll be able to sell his own products without white interference, without being marginalized, be able to set his own price point. And I think that a lot of, like what they did to Michael Jackson when he tried to do it, and Bill Cosby, now they're doing it to him when he tried to do it, own something, not work for white people, you get ridiculed, and I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Wow. That's one I would, I don't know, I haven't followed that a whole lot, the situation with LeVar Ball. I know a little bit about it and them ridiculing this black basketball player's father. I think he's in the draft. I guess he'll be drafted maybe this next month, whenever the draft is. But I would be confidently be willing to predict that white people are going to significantly disrupt his NBA career. I know I've had this conversation even when I was more confused about racism. Anything that looks like black entertainers, athletes looking like they are trying to move towards black self-respect and being independent of racist control, oh man, we're going to do everything we can to sabotage. I think Dr. Claude Anderson would probably have commentary on that. Other folks we have not heard from.
Yes, have you heard?
Yes, sir. Young scholar in the Greetings. Bay Area.
Greetings, guys, and to the rest of the callers. So based on one of the audios that were played in this session, there was one about how Seattle has raised the rent in a lot of apartments, especially in black neighborhoods. I found that very interesting, and I connected that to, I connected it to Oakland, basically, where, back when I was young, there were a lot of black people here. We were living just fine. We lived in, projects and basically, quote-unquote, the hood, and we were able to afford our rent. And then later on, I think it started when I was in, middle school, going on to high school. That's when gentrification started, and basically gentrification is where, on our terms, where the rent is raised, all of our bills are being raised, and it's raised to where black people can't afford it at the time they need to pay it, and they have to move out to other countries. They have to migrate to other places, and then all of the white people move in and start taking over, and it just makes it a lot different. And I noticed that it created a lot of diversity, for one, a lot of diversity between not only white people, but the previous black people that could still afford the rent that's being due. But I found that part interesting, and also I feel like they're just trying to move the black people out of Seattle, period. Like, just to keep them in a separate place, like they're trying to do with Oakland. That's what I feel like. I'm not sure if it's correct or not, but that's just my opinion about it. Just feel like they're trying to move all the black people out and bring all the white people in one place to start, like, a white union, I guess. But it's just, I found it quite, not surprising, but, like, interesting just to hear about this going on in other places around the world. Because, honestly, I thought it was just in Oakland, but now I know it's in Seattle and more likely other places, especially in the United States. Going back to it again, just feel like they're just trying to move the black people out of probably the country. Just keep, I guess, quote unquote, take them back to Africa, probably. But yeah, that's just my opinion about one of those audios, and that's all I wanted to share. Thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely. Great to hear. Again, our young scholar in the Bay Area. That pattern of just racial dislocation, also called gentrification, of dislocating the black people, that is very widespread. Washington, D.C. is another area where there's been a lot of articles and things talking about, because Washington, D.C., they have a lot of black people, and the numbers of black people living in D.C. has been decreasing over the past years. Dr. Welsing talked about that a lot before she transitioned. Quite a few areas where the same, New York is one, I think Thomas in New York has talked about that as well, but quite a few, even Chicago, I think Pam will probably have a few words on that coming up. I would say the only difference with Seattle is that Seattle does not have a lot of black people to begin with. Like the sound clip that I play at the beginning, it says, Seattle has a little bit of everything. I like to say Seattle has a lot of everything. I was going to add in just to be funny, except black people. Seattle does not have a lot of black people by any stretch. I did want to ask really quick, young caller, if you're still there, sir. You said when this quote-unquote gentrification happened that it brings a lot of diversity. What do you mean when you say diversity?
Oh, when I say diversity, I mean, like, is bringing a lot more culture into Oakland. That's what I found beneficial about it, just bringing the white people here just to get a taste of what they are thinking about. And then we have other minorities coming in as well. I just found it quite astounding how much culture we can get out of other people and how we celebrate it in Oakland. That's what I meant by diversity.
I see. Thank you for answering the question, sir. The other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Do we miss folks? Love it when the people call in with hands up and then are silent.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, folks. I think what the young scholar from the Bay Area said it had me thinking, because one thing that I've noticed about non-white, specifically black people, is that we really don't, I think partially maybe it's that we don't understand, so we can't hold on to a lot of negative feelings, what people would consider negative feelings. But I think I'd argue that it's even possibly genetic for us to do that, to embrace other people, to be open to other people, to learn from other people, to teach other people that are different from ourselves, to want to show other people, like to always think good of other people, to be able to think that there's something good, you know, when they're able to come in. So I do. Like, but that, I think, also is kind of our downfall, too, because the evidence for me is showing that other people don't have that towards us. And the one clip that I wanted to talk about specifically was the clip about the blood pressure. And Gus, you were going to say, or you said what I was going to say. I'm not so sure that that's, you know, accurate all the way. I think that this is me personally, I'm not saying that you said that, but I think that being around white people is more detrimental to non-white, specifically black people's health, than it is to live in those areas. And I was a little frustrated with the clip because what I'm assuming is a white person, white male, wanted to say, well, we just need to end segregation. And I remember it took me a long time, Gus helped me to really understand there's really no such thing as segregation. There never was. We non-white black people have always been living amongst these white people since we've been here, like real intimate, close spaces. Even if we have, you know, a cabin over there or whatever, we've never been able to be completely separate from them. So the term segregation is a misleading one. And so I didn't like its use in the article. I didn't think it was constructive. And I don't think that, like, if all living environments are made equal, I don't think that non-white, specifically black people, will have lower blood pressure just by living amongst white people. I don't think that at all. I think that black people have to deal with a whole lot psychologically when we are around white people, especially if we are not the majority in that particular environment. So I just felt like that was misleading. And I'm trying to figure out why. Like, I think, I don't know if white people like to be just amongst white people, because then, you know, maybe they turn on each other too fast. So they like to have us around so that there's always someone to watch and spy. Like, I'm beginning to think that that kind of level of, that just might be part of their pathology or psychology, that that's just how they operate. So they need us to be there. I look forward to the day when we're just like, nah, I could take the really big house over there in the suburbs, but it's not really worth it. And I think if we stay or return back, then we would do a lot of good by not leaving folks behind. And, yeah, my experience is being around white people is not healthy at all, at all. We should only be dealing with them at work or something like that, but not living around them. And the way that they have these developments, it's like there's no privacy also in these suburbs. It's not like you're sitting on an acre and a half or 2 acres of land. You're talking about houses. Like, if you yelling or playing your music, people can hear you. If you cooking, people can smell what you're cooking. Like, it's real close. It's real tight. I don't think living around white people is where it's at for us. But thank you for listening.
For sure. 1842, or Emmy, excuse me. Other folks who dialed in that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, this is Rochelle. I've called in before. I missed the clip tonight because I was working on a second job, and I do plan to go back and watch the, or listen to the archives, rather. But I really just wanted to call in to express this appreciation for you guys, the host, as well as the other callers. It's very constructive to me, and listening to the way the callers interact, the way the callers question things, interact with one another in terms of providing their worldview, their experiences, and just seeing that helps me in clarifying my own behavior, my own actions, even my own thought processes. So I just wanted to call in to express appreciation for that. And I'm hoping to be able to call into workplace racism because now that I've obtained a second job, which it requires a different level of training, I'm interacting with people in a different way. I'm seeing a lot more things than I see in my day job, my quote unquote day job. So again, I'm just calling into. I didn't get to hear any of the clips, but it's always really constructive, rewarding, enjoyable to listen to the callers interact with one another and analyze the information, analyze the world around them. And even the caller who just spoke up before me, the female caller, what she said about people of African descent innately having something within us that's more trusting, more willing to train and help others, like instinctively, I completely agree with that. I think that that is something that we have. And in developing our own code and understanding the world better, what we have to kind of not fight against it, but be very discerning in how we use it, because given that we are facing this huge problem where there isn't a solution as yet, we have to be aware that we shouldn't be so ready to
necessarily think the best of others only because it has been to our detriment in the past. And I'll mute my line.
Great. Appreciate that. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free.
Hello, may I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, this is Red from Ohio. I did get a chance to hear the clips this time, and I guess I would start with the issue, like other people have pointed out, about the whole if Black people lived in segregated neighborhoods, then that would be better for them. But then also, Gus, you had pointed out that there was other segments saying that, so that would not be so good for them, even though, you know, because that would just being in such close proximity to whites, that could cause people, that could cause non-whites problems. But then also what another thing that we all are, what I've heard before, and I think also not only on the show, but in news, in different news segments and what have you, is that even if we move into these places, non-whites move into places where there are whites, where there are better schools, better services, they just take them out once too many of us move there. And just another thing about the whole white flight and gentrification, I see it also here in Ohio, like just where my sister lives, where it seems like it's been a primarily Black neighborhood for decades. And like the more I see that they do to like the parks around it, or even like there's a hospital not that far away, I see how they're slowly moving in more whites, or they are tearing down some old, very, very old houses, very old brick houses, and replacing them with new, like, I don't know, plywood or whatever new type of material that they built the houses with. So that was one thing. The other thing about, there was a segment that you played about Nevada schools, and I know I have spoken about Nevada before, and not only is it with like Nevada being, and like other schools, they're more willing to be more racist, like the children are racist, but also the teachers are racist as well, and even their policies, especially like with the clothing policy. I've heard of students, like Black female students, who, let's say they wear shorts or a skirt or something like that, they have gotten sent home when a young white woman might wear something that is definitely too short, too revealing, and it's fine. And that could be pointed out, but it still doesn't make a difference. Another thing about Nevada that I had noticed was that I had actually, when I had lived there, the state had paid for my training because I was unemployed, and they paid for me to get job training. And at the time, it was me and a Black male friend, and we had both went to like this unemployment office to ask for some type of assistance, at least, you know, resumes or something like that. And before they would even offer him assistance, he would have had to, I think it was, sign up for the draft or something along those lines. And then that made me think about how Dr. Curry had spoken about even like the differences between, and not only him, but just that they'll have the differences between, there'll be females who will have more training or college degrees versus males. And just in my personal experience, that's how it kind of related with me. I guess the last thing that I did want to touch on was the going back to the segregated communities. I remember hearing in high school a teacher, he had spoken in class briefly about how his mother, he had looked at his mother's deed, and it also had, I don't think it had like nigger specifically spelled out in the deed that she couldn't sell, resell the house to, you know, a nigger or a Negro, but it did actually have basically you can't sell the house to Blacks. So it was definitely, and I don't even know why he brought that up, because it wasn't like a, I don't even think that we were talking about it, but it made me think about how they, how whites, they do tend to, I feel like they get some type of joy just reliving all the detrimental things, all the trauma that they have put on Blacks. That's all I have to share. Thank you.
Are there other folks we've not heard from at all?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the hosts, the callers, and the listeners. I'm listening to the clips. The first clip that I heard when I dialed in was about the Black women and their infants or their children dying from lack of, I guess, health services from white people. And I thought that was particularly interesting, just to focus on Black women and the infant, and how helpless the infant is, and how more susceptible the infant is than the adult to certain environmental factors. I was just researching something today. I've been researching it actually for a while, but today I'm also researching it, trying to figure out, focusing on the same thing, women and infants, but not the Black women and infants, but the white women and infants. And I'm figuring that, as I said before, if we're able to get the atmosphere to a certain temperature for a sustained period of time, for such a period of time, that it will actually cause the white women to probably have stillbirths for the entire generation, probably. But definitely increased heat temperature would cause preterm births. It would cause heart attacks. And this is just looking at a couple of documents. But to get to that point, perhaps bonfires would work, perhaps not. But I think that it would work, because it does superheat. I've seen it heat the environment just right around that bonfire. I've been reading articles about bonfires increasing the temperature of areas, you know, and there's actually laws on how many bonfires you can do in certain areas. There's laws that limit them. But because I think that the laws are laxed in certain areas, we may be able to, if it does work, we may be able to utilize that during the summer months to get the temperature to a temperature where we can still withstand it, but they can't, given that they're albinos. And there may be, or there likely would be, a lot of collateral damage, but not too much, you know. But anyway, that's one thing. The other thing is the segment where they were talking about white people going to the suburbs and then putting in the deed that if the property can't be sold back to Black people at any time, and that the government, white government, was helping these white people do this this thing. So now what they've done is they've taken the higher ground. And what I think we need to do is, one, we don't focus on trying to buy up all the property from them, because you're not going to be able to do that. It's locked in as far as their system is concerned. All that trying to buy up the more property than them, that's not going to work. But you can at least position yourself, take the hills, because we're going to need the hills. You don't fight uphill. That's not a good idea. But anyway, take the hills, buy land in the hills. You can figure that out. As a people, we can figure that out. And that was mainly the things I had to say. And then the other thing is just, I don't have a desire for friends because we are in a war. The only desire I have as far as communicating with people is solving this problem. I know everybody needs love and all that other sort of thing, and whatever that is, we need some type of communication with each other. But right now we have to solve this problem. Thank you.
Right on. I just want to say, when you were saying everybody needs love and some sort, I was thinking companionship. That might be a good term for what you were referencing. Maybe, maybe not. But I think people often seek companionship so that they can have contact with another person where it's enjoyable. But I do think that that is very important, that under wartime conditions, that just prioritizing our use of time and energy. I think Josh Wickett, who did a lot of great counter-racist work at thecode.net, sharing some of Mr. Fuller's concepts, he was saying the same thing. He said, I don't, what they call hang out. I don't hang out. If I'm going to be with someone, we have to have, you know, a specific purpose, a specific constructive purpose for what we are going to be doing. And if I ascertain that it's not constructive, then I don't hang out. I think that's a great way of thinking about our use of time and energy to replace the system of white supremacy. Other folks we've not heard from at all. If you have a hand up, you should be with us. Other folks that have a hand up that we have not heard from at all.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I just wanted to make some commentary on an article that I came across earlier today. It's I think it's located in Minnesota. It's a college called St. Olaf, S-T period O-L-A-F. And it was like a 6-minute audio article. And it was talking about, I guess, some incidents of racism that's been occurring. And I wanted to bring that up because what they talked about toward the beginning of the audio was about how I think it was 9 incidents, and out of the 9, they suddenly focused on one being a so-called hoax, because that term has been or is being used and promoted. And I think apparently they even have some black people using that term, you know, because of our victimization. But that term hoax is being used, I guess, you know, maybe some victims are perhaps being, I guess, compensated, maybe with finances or something like that. I can't really speculate too deeply about it. But they were interviewing different students on the campus about this incident, or just, you know, about the incidents of racism. And one guy was saying he just felt like he felt totally unsafe for having a black identity or something like that. And the way that they were introducing the narrator, the female narrator, was introducing the different students. She said that the 2 white students that they interviewed classified as Midwestern white. Okay, not like that's like I never even heard of that before. Said Midwestern white. So, and she said that these 2 students were in support of non-white students, I guess, in their response to racism. And, you know, they gave an abstract response because these are, I guess, college students or whatever. And there was another, I suspect it was a white person, but they didn't introduce her as white. They just said she called herself a conservative student. And this female student, I think is a white female. She was saying that she was talking about the term systematic racism and how nobody understands it. And I don't think she was saying people should discontinue using the word, but she was saying like how, I guess, the organization that was there, I can't remember what they called it. They were talking about like different racist incidents or racial incidents that's been occurring on the campus, certain notes and things like that being left on buildings and people, I guess, being assaulted. And she was saying, you know, hey, what are the solutions that we should bring up or mention? And I noticed that, like on different TV shows and segments, people, like white people, will say, you know, what are the solutions? And they won't really necessarily point the focus on, you know, individual white behaviors and things like that. So, you know, she was basically mentioning how this group was mentioning racism, and she was bringing up another thing. She was saying, you know, I have no problem with talking about that. And, you know, they were saying that they can bring in a change in curriculum, you know, bring in different, I guess, she used the term ethnic culture studies or whatever. And she said she had a problem with other things that they were mentioning, like gender neutral bathrooms and housing. That's the term she used. And she was saying, well, none of these things have to do with racism. So, you know, I kind of agree with her on that one. You know, I don't know what's going on with how they, I think that term conflation been used when racism is being discussed. And, you know, I'm not sure if they're having white people with these different groups that are doing these protests. So I found that interesting how they did that audio segment. And it's for St. Olaf University. I think that's what it's called. And it's in Minnesota, and that's all I have for now. Thank you.
Fascinating. That is when they have these sort of events where racism is supposed to be talked about, and then it's time for gender-neutral bathrooms. That's what they had at the White Privilege Conference in 2010. And that's the exact term that they were using, gender-neutral bathrooms. If you go back and listen to those 2010 broadcasts that we did live from the White Privilege Conference in Wisconsin, you'll hear me talking about those gender-neutral bathrooms. But they are great at that. They'll get you in. Ostensibly, we're going to talk about racism, and then you get there and it's gay rights and gender-neutral bathrooms and heteronormativity and anything and everything but white people practicing white supremacy. They are outstanding at that sort of thing. And also, in my view, again, using logic, got to be a critical thinker. It does not make sense if someone is positing, if this was the conservative thinker or whoever it was saying that systematic racism, no one knows what it is. That is not possible. If a white person made that statement, I would say that they are being flagrantly deceptive and depending on non-white people accepting that without using logic. Racism, white supremacy, they want to call it systematic racism, is a crime. It is individuals classified as white practicing a crime against people they say are not white. On that basis, it's not possible. It's not logical. It's totally absurd to say that no one knows what the crime of systematic racism is. That's not possible. The people that are practicing systematic racism, they know exactly what it is in detail. And you can think about that like any other criminal activity. If we're talking about, I'm going to go and enslave these dark people over here, that's another crime. The people that are doing the enslaving, they know all about that. They know about building what you got to do to, you know, steal people and enslave them. You can't do that and be ignorant of the process. Use logic. Did I hear that correct? It was systematic racism. Was that the term that was used?
Yes, sir. Yes, right. Sir. She was saying how nobody understands it. And I'm like, well, did you ever ask for a definition? And I'm thinking, nobody like who doesn't understand it. Mm-hmm. I mean, she sounded like she did understand it, but she was just, once again, like you said, the deception. You got to find some kind of way to deflect. So that's what it sounded like she was doing.
Standard operating procedure. Hopefully, Cal's listeners understand that to a great degree at this point. We'll give out the number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Are there folks we've not heard from at all who have a hand up?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
appreciate everybody. Hope everybody's having a good evening. 2812 from VA. I didn't get a chance to hear any of the earlier broadcasts. I was on the road, but just wanted to share a couple of things that I've observed. I think I mentioned this last week, earlier in the week, about the Richard Spencer incident. I was actually able to speak with other victims of racism this evening at my son's basketball tournament, non-white males and females who were not aware that this white supremacist rally had occurred right down the street, about, you know, 40 minutes from where we reside. And they were just in shock when I was showing them the pictures and things of that nature. And I had just mentioned, like, you know, that's typical. And they were like, you're right. And they were like, wow. Just different reactions. Also, I do help out with a radio show, and it's in a local town, and they actually interviewed Richard Spencer. I was supposed to be there, but I was not. So I'm going to put in a request. If anyone is aware of Richard Spencer, he's going to be on the show again. I talked to the station manager that handles the show that I help him do. So I'd like to get some questions that from Kyle's listeners, maybe that we could ask Mr. Spencer that will be constructive in reference to us maybe helping other victims that are listening to the show. And just to give you a little background, this show comes on an FM station that is, like, I'd probably say it's really popular in Southern Virginia. So there's going to be a lot of non-white people that are listening to this broadcast. So if anybody, or Gus or anybody else, has questions that they would like to ask, that they think would be constructive, maybe can forward them to Gus or something like that. One other thing, and then I'll stop, is I was reading my code book today, and I think it's important that sometimes we pick it up, if you haven't picked it up for a while, to just go through it. And I just got to a section to where Mr. Fuller was talking about the word hostage. And it says, a hostage is also a person who is forced to do harm to others because of fear of those persons who have power over them. And that just made me immediately think about when non-white people call someone else a coon, a sambo, or, you know, I would have reacted differently. I just say, no, that person is now acting as a hostage. Because in the system of racism, white supremacy, that's pretty much what happens. And I'll just read the definition one more time. As a hostage is a person who is forced to do harm to others because of the fear of those persons who have power over them. And a lot of times in all the books that we read and constant situations, sometimes the reason why, I can speak for myself, that we may not behave in the right manner or say things or do things is because we are in fear of who? We're in fear of white people. So that's all I wanted to share. And thanks, Gus. I'll continue to listen. Sorry, I called in late. And I wasn't able to hear everything earlier.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. I'll just make a report on two things that I experienced this week. First, the championship team is at the end of spring practice. You know, they had an inter-squad scrimmage. But earlier in the week, the principal requested a meeting with all of the coaches. So, of course, you know, a caution light comes on, and it makes me think, you know, damn, I'm thinking like I'm still, I'm not retired. You know, I got to go to a meeting, some kind of meeting with the principal, some sort of administrator. So anyway, we go in there, and, you know, all of the coaches, head coach included, of course. And, it was the principal and one of his APs, and he first just started going over what his ambitions are about the football program and what he's doing, blah, blah, blah. And what it came down to be as far as the meeting is concerned is that he is asking the players to raise $100 a piece for the rings, which I thought was very ridiculous. I'm not so much into the rings anymore, but it is a tradition, you know, that sort of thing. But for someone to do the work that those young people did and went above and beyond, they should be the last people that ask to go raise some money. It should be, and I use the term, the adults. And because they met all the requirements. You don't have a right to be a student athlete. Well, the athlete part of the student athlete. You have to qualify. You have to qualify GPA, and you have to have the behavior that is a demand of behavior, so you can stay on a team or interscholastic team. In order to do that, let alone talking about being successful as far as winning and going to a championship. So they've already did everything they did. I actually expressed that to the principal and his assistant. And so the other guy who seems to be a younger guy, you know, kind of like in a sarcastic way, well, what are your suggestions? I say, well, I don't raise money. I'm a football coach, but I do would think that there's a lot of corporations around here, and if some of them actually, some of these children at this high school patronize them. So go ask them for money. They certainly have enough money to buy the rings, just you know, out of their slush fund or whatever. You know, you want to call it just miscellaneous fees. They can pay for these rings. And so anyway, they placing all that in consideration. But nevertheless, even if several of the kids that I know that probably wouldn't be able to afford $100, let alone talking about their parents, to be able to do it, and I would assist in order to get some of them rings myself if that's cause to do. Moving on, mind you now, if any one of the callers don't know, 99% of these children on the team are non-white black males. Moving on, was asked to attend I guess you want to call it a meeting, something about commemorating, as we all, I think, would know that May 19th was Minister Malcolm's birthday. And there was a group of people who were meeting at a house that is called a Kaumba House. And they were, according to my knowledge, reported was recognizing Minister Malcolm's birthday. So I go, and I've been at these events, you know, off and on for over 30 years. And so go there, you know, with the, you know, some people were dressed in African garbs and that sort of thing. And basically the idea with Minister Malcolm was not the centered event. They were just using that to individuals to sell things or to advertise whatever personal projects that they were doing, which kind of like, you know, I thought was a little bit disappointing, because I certainly wouldn't have went there if I knew that. But nevertheless, you know, to each his own, I guess, you know, people got to find a way to make a living, that sort of thing. And so anyway, I just sat through it because, you know, an associate of mine asked me to attend. And this one non-white black male started talking about the idea that he is tired of the quote-unquote United States and all of its problems. And I made up my mind and I left and went back, quote-unquote, home to Africa, Tanzania to be exact, the place that's called Tanzania, and didn't know anything about farming and learn how to farm and plant. And he was basically just describing on how successful, quote-unquote, he has been into planning this and planning that. I'm sitting there. I'm about to just get up out of my seat and throw the chair or something like that, you know. But I've learned to be patient when I'm hearing people talking. And then again, there's such thing as VGQ. But what clicks in my mind is to go into the question mode. So when he finished with his very long spiel, very long dissertation on what he's doing and how successful he is, I said, well, given the fact that do you have the idea that all of that, what you say you have done, can be destroyed within a few seconds? And it was like crickets in the background. And basically he said, I put it in the question from the standpoint of what would take place is if there's attempt to destroy this is what you was attempting to do. And he said, oh, that's a good question. That's a good question. But he never did really, you know, kind of like answer. He didn't answer the question at all, you know, but just a thought, you know, as far as that concerned. But it ended up being, some constructive conversation, even with the non-white black male who was making his report about what he was doing with the farming. I said, that's a good idea to have that skill and to be able to apply it. Matter of fact, some other people in the meeting also stated that you really didn't have to go to Africa to do that. You could make that attempt right where you're at in this part of the world, and whatever problems you're going to have, it's basically the same people, right. You know, that sort of thing.
Appreciate
that. Yeah, that's basically what I went through this week. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Just wanted to make sure we got the other folks in we hadn't heard from. If you have additional commentary, retired firefighter, or anyone else, once we get everybody in, once I make sure everybody's got their one opportunity to share, feel free. If you have additional commentary that you want to share, we should have time. Is there anyone who has a hand up that we've not heard from at all? Anybody who has a hand up that had commentary they wanted to share? Folks up that we've not heard from, I guess they called in more recently. If you have a hand up, feel free. Again, love the people call it. They might be in a location where they're not able to speak now. So I guess the people that dialed in more recently with the hand up who we're not hearing from as of yet will check back in a minute or so to see if they are in a spot where they can share.
What have you heard?
Yes, ma'am, Princess.
Yes. I was just calling in. I was going to call in a little bit earlier, but I had a family function that I had to attend to. But I was calling in. I was going to call in also Thursday, but just been busy with work and some other issues. Going on. I've been seeing a lot of these articles about black people, black children or kids in high school or whatnot, having issues in relation to their hair. And I myself am wearing natural hair, dealing with the stuff in the workplace. Is a reference to black people and their hair. I think my problem has been lately, I don't know if people have probably been on my page and saw that I subscribe to a couple of natural hair groups. Not that I selected them, I guess people added me to them, but nonetheless, I've just noticed that there's a lot of people in there who classify themselves as white. in these dread and lock groups, and I just find it disheartening and frustrating because it seems like the Black people in these groups do not see the correlation of having a white person or white people in these supposed Black groups. And at the same time, we're having these issues with children being, you know, discouraged or being assaulted because of their hair, as well as, you know, we're still being discriminated against because of our hair. And I was recently kicked out of one of these groups because of my opinions of me and a few others, apparently by some Black people. I had looked up the information. I guess they were these four Black female administrators on this page, apparently. And just really seeing how Black people were just caping for these two lone white people that was apparently locking their hair, if you will. And like I said, it's just, I don't know. It was kind of hard for me to take anybody serious as far as anybody that would comment on the issue on my page or within the group, as far as, you know, whenever they would share articles of these issues with these kids having problems with their hair being accepted in school and stuff like that. Because I'm like, you know. I did receive a call from corporate. We've been playing a little bit of phone tag. I would have called Mr. Fuller in regards to my workplace situation. But I just kind of left it where, you know, just leaving it, the ball in their court, because I don't want it to look like, oh, I'm just trying to, you know, just bother anybody. I just have my information that Mr. Fuller had told me to type up and, you know, fax or send to corporate in regards to what we discussed. And, you know, until I, you know, we can have a time where I'm available to speak to whoever the investigator or personnel is from HR or corporate. You know, I've just been leaving messages and stuff like that for them to let them know that I'm following up with them and stuff like that.
Is that all you had?
That's it for now.
All right, on.
Yes.
Appreciate that, Princess. Workplace Racism is on Thursday. Always great if you, I think I've encouraged other listeners as well. You can reach out to Mr. Fuller if you want to get his input. He generally is very helpful, very eager to help. It's been my experience. Other victims of racism deal with problems in the workplace. So glad to hear, Princess, you were able to get some strategies from Mr. Fuller and then implementing those. Being consistent with that, documenting. Thursday, Workplace Racism, again, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you want to share tips, give us updates, let us know. That's what we do every Thursday evening. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, you should be with us. Watch the background noise, please, as well. Are there folks that we've missed completely? Anybody that has a hand up that we've not heard from at all? Okay, I think we got everybody. Might have missed one or two folks, but, you know, maybe they will comment later. Other folks, even if you've already spoken up, if you have commentary, additional comments, questions, feel free.
Bob, you heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Just wanted to say, in reference to what the firefighter said, now, I remember being in high school and playing football, and I went to a fairly diverse Catholic school, and winning the state championship. We won it twice, and getting a memo for the rings. And What the white people did was exactly what the firefighter said. They went to the local pizzerias in that area, different places that the students patronized, and they got the money up for the rain. We didn't have to pay anything for them. We didn't even have to go and solicit the funds ourselves. They went and did it themselves. Now, these are all the Catholics. No one can get money like them. But what he's saying is absolutely right. You know, you expect fairly marginalized, poorer children to go and buy a $100 ring. And to be honest with you, I couldn't tell you where either of those rings are or any of the county championship rings, any of that stuff is today. I know it's in my mother's house probably somewhere, but I wouldn't even know where to begin looking for that stuff. So the importance factor of it in the long term isn't that important. I just wanted to comment on that as far as what he said. As far as the clips on Mr. Curry, I'm shocked that it's taken this long for white people to go at Mr. Curry, Dr. Curry. Just listening to some of the commentary he's made on this show, and I always thought it was just amazing that he's been able to keep that job, you know, and stay in good standings with that institution and have some of the views he has. And obviously it looks like it might be catching up to him somewhat. Although he hasn't been fired or anything, they might not even go that far, but it's just putting everyone on notice there that this is someone that we need to look at. I think it's pretty standard as per what they do. And the last little tidbit I wanted to add in as far as going back to when I mentioned LeVar Ball earlier and your commentary, and just to say that several of the NBA players have said they're going to try to hurt this guy when he comes into the league because they don't like what the father's doing. And just a lot of the, listening to the, feeding into the negative media, looking for their white validation. They're going to come out with these type of posts that they're going to go and hurt another black man for him trying to actually own his own brand and brand his own company. And I just felt like that was totally a part of the system, how they often can get us to turn on one another. What did the guy call it earlier? He called it, he got it from the code book. I thought that was great.
Hostage?
It wasn't victim. Hostage, yeah. A bunch of millionaire black hostages in the NBA who feel like they have to go out now and stand up to this black man for the white man. It's just, you know, it's just very compelling. It shows the system we're in and the mindset we're under. I mute my line. Thank you.
I did want to say that is relevant. It just happens to be that we're talking about entertainment, but it fits any context. It's been my experience. Whites, when they start verbally attacking a non-white person, particularly a black person, many victims of white supremacy will also be impacted by that. And they will add on in verbally attacking and talking bad about that non-white person. That's just how the system of racism, white supremacy works. That happens frequently using the same logic that was presented earlier. That's what can happen to hostages under the system of white supremacy. But I was having a conversation this week with a Cows listener, and she was talking about basketball, same thing. And she said, I'm rooting for the Celtics. She's not even in Massachusetts, but for whatever reason, she's rooting for the Celtics, whatever. And this was before the series they were in started. And she said, LeBron James, he never gets injured. And I hate his guts. And I said, wow, that's interesting. Why do you not like him? And it took a while. Like she did, it wasn't like she had a list of, you know, prepared reasons. Like I've, you know, paid attention or he did this or he did that. It took a while for her to manufacture her list of reasons. And she said, you know, man, what if he could get hurt? I mean, gosh, he never gets hurt. I hope he gets hurt or something. And I was just appalled, like, to sit around and wish harm on another black person. I mean, I don't care, you know, who you want to win. I live in Seattle. I've been in the city where the local sports team won the Super Bowl. And It did not make any impact on my life. It did not make anything. It did not improve anything for me. It did not solve any problems. They're kicking black people out of the city right now. They just went to two Super Bowls, and they're booting black people out of the city left and right. It'll be, you know, Richard Sherman, and he might be leaving too. So, I mean, who knows? It might not even be any black people left to cheer on the Seahawks. And I told this to the listener that I think just what I just said. Whites talk bad about Mr. James frequently. They talk bad about LaVar Ball frequently. And black people, period. They talk bad about them all the time. And a lot of times, victims of racism, we end up being contaminated with that racist rhetoric, and we end up doing the same thing. That's what, when Dr. Welsing, when she talks about black self-respect, it doesn't mean that I have to like a person or be in love with this person or agree with their views, but I'm not out of black self-respect. I'm not going to sit around and talk bad about this black person, regardless of what they're doing or what they're saying. And I certainly am not going to sit around and talk about wishing harm or, you know, I'm going to injure this black person because I don't like their, you know, marketing strategy and what they're doing with their paraphernalia. I mean, wow, that is the system of white supremacy on display again. Whites are most to blame. Other folks have commentary?
Yes, sir. That reminds me of the Ponce twins, two non-white black males, one plays for the Pittsburgh Steelers and the other for the Miami Dolphins, who has spoken up for the white male murderer who committed suicide, former tight end of the New England Patriots, but yet participated in the terror and the torture of a black male for the Miami Dolphins. Well, at least the one that is the starting center for the Miami Dolphins, that half of the twin. In defense of that white male who was causing havoc on the team against this non-white black male that briefly played for the Dolphins and went to Stanford. I just can't remember his name. But I think you recall the incident because it really went national.
Jonathan.
Yes. They are two examples of that, what you two guys are talking about. Also, back to the ring situation, the white male athletic director had the nerve to give some sort of negative cajoling to the head coach about the only white male that's on the team because he was able to raise some money. Mind you, now his parent is owners of a business in the area. And I just thought that was such a joke. You know, I don't say too much, you know, as far as they're concerned, because from the standpoint of if they're not necessarily talking to me, but when it comes to the children, I'm going to speak on their behalf. Because, as I mentioned before, 9 out of 10 of them are non-white black males. So those are just some of the observations that I've had. Thank you.
The person who dialed in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. I just wanted to get the caller on the headset. The caller on the headset that we haven't heard from at all. Did you have commentary?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
I wanted to ask Thomas from New York a question. I wanted to ask him if stop and frisk is still an active practice, primarily targeting blacks in New York City. Because I know that when de Blasio was placed in office, he was going to reform that program. And I wanted to know if Thomas in New York, given his experience living there, if he's seen any change or if it still continues to target blacks. And the reason why I ask is because I know New York City kind of sets the tone and model for other police departments throughout the state. So thank you.
Absolutely. It targets black and dark Latinos. And just a tidbit on that is right after he came in and he spoke very bad about stop and frisk. It did stop, but it didn't stop because he said something. It stopped because the police stopped working. They felt like, you know, he was against them. They turned their backs on him, and they weren't going to fight crime. But as things settled down and got back to normal, you could get stop and frisk in New York City, but it happens everywhere. It's not just New York. I mean, I would say anywhere you live, they could stop. I was stopped a few weeks ago. They said I fit the description of someone that committed a crime. I'm 6'5". That guy was 5'6". He was a lot darker than me. So, I mean, you know, they can use any reason to do it. I think that that's what they're doing now. They're just using a reason to say, oh, we're doing this for this reason or that reason. But it's not just flat out. We're just frisking for no reason. Another thing is, since the terrorism thing, and this I find impacts black people as well, they can stop you at any time on the train or as you're entering the subway and just look through your bag, which I think is, and I see the thing set up here in Harlem, like, I'm like, you know, we don't have any terrorists around here, you know, I mean, but, you know, it's just what they could do.
Right on. Appreciate the question and answer. I'm not sure, was that Red in Ohio who was speaking up, or was that one of our other female callers?
No, it was me. I just actually had a question for the parents on the line. It's been something that's been on my mind for weeks, and I keep forgetting to bring it up during the compensatory call-in. I actually have a family member who, a younger family member, who's still in, like, elementary school. And I had heard that he has not gotten any homework since he came back from Christmas break. And I know, like, when I was in school, especially, like, middle school, high school, that was not something that was ever heard of. Like, we would still have to do something, even read a book or something, but he doesn't have to do anything. And there's no, and it doesn't seem like that's something that has even changed. So it seems like not only are they not even making, you know, and he goes to public school, but it seems like not only are, like, whites, you know, expelling children or suspending children, but it's like they're not even giving them things to do outside of school. So that was definitely something that was concerning me. So that's all. That's the only other thing I had.
I'll encourage, if we have parents, to speak up if they have commentary on that. I do not have offspring. However, I do know, just from checking the news regularly, that that has been reported regularly for about the past 12 months. It's been kind of a new push for many different teachers to not give out homework or to give out very little homework. And some people were saying, you know, that they don't like this because it just means that children now have lots and lots of free time. They have nothing to do, so they can just come home and, you know, watch TV or play video games or whatever else they're going to do once they get out. I guess if it's black children, they'll go out and, you know, commit strong arm robberies. But this, I have heard this, people talking about this, and in some places people are saying that they don't like it, and other places for various, and I think they were given a variety of reasons, not having textbooks, lots of different, there were other reasons, but where they were saying, well, maybe this is something that we should do, either going with a lot less homework or no homework at all. But if we have parents who have any input on this, that would be grand.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
That is accurate. As a parent of a high schooler and of a middle schooler, I can tell you from my oldest, he had a French teacher that literally might have given him homework in January, and then the last assignments were given maybe 2 weeks ago. And he had another class. It was the same thing. Same thing with the middle school. It was a little different situation, but maybe half the classes are not giving away homework. What I did myself to when I started noticing that trend was I gave them work myself. The internet is a great resource, and I know you'll probably recommend this, but there's a million different things you can give them on racism or even just anything constructive to keep their brains functioning in those classes. So if it's like an English class, you can maybe give them, you know, higher level work or something. But that's just a suggestion that I have. But that's not going to be uncommon. I don't know what the system of white supremacy intends to do with not giving out so much homework, but for me, it sounds like it's something to benefit white female teachers. In some way or some form, it's going to benefit them. I'll be in my life.
Benefit them? Do you have any speculation as to how that would benefit white female teachers?
My brain was still thinking about it when I made that statement, so maybe it wouldn't have been the best thing to say, but it's just for sometimes, even like in my kids' school, it's like, oh, we have to study for more SOLs, or we have to do all these different testing, and it's like less time actually teaching kids to do something. And I'm like, well, what does that benefit? You know, I'm thinking, how does that benefit them? Is it make the qualifications easier for them to become educators? I could just be going totally left field, but I just think that it's going to definitely benefit the system of white supremacy, maybe not benefit them directly, but giving kids less homework in order to accomplish, like, what? You know, I even asked my kids with, like, this quote-unquote new math. My fiance is a teacher. I asked her, why'd they even change it? She said, I have no idea. She was an educator. She worked in New York City public schools for years. But obviously the people making those decisions are white people. So I don't want to get totally off, but you're correct. I should have thought about that before I said it. But give me a little bit more time. I might think so.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry. I feel like I did understand him as far as how they, because it does make sense how the white women's teachers would benefit, because what I've heard from teachers that I've known is that when they usually have to grade homework after hours, and that's just making their job a whole lot easier. But then it's also like what I, and I had been working with some of the younger males and females in my family, and actually making them read the newspaper and trying to pick out things that were somewhat about racism. But I definitely understand, because I know, like I said, it seems like they're not really even grading the papers. So I remember when I was in school, they would make all the other students grade their own papers, or like some teachers, I guess the ones that were halfway decent or cared somewhat about their job, they would take the homework home. So, but thank you, though, for that.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good point about making it easier for white women teachers. Then they can, you know, go home and kick their feet up and watch, you know, reruns of Sex and the City or whatever else they're doing, plotting on how they're going to suspend the next crop of black students in terms of them not having a great homework or even assign it. Do we have any other? Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just wanted to say on that. My mother was a school teacher for 35 years, and I remember if we had to go somewhere and she was grading papers, you know, I would offer to help, you know, so we could get it done faster, because it did take up a lot of time. But I find that this push for less homework and stuff kind of coincides with some of the laws that are holding teachers more accountable for the students' lack of success in school. So per se, if kids don't do their homework, which I think was a huge thing here in New York City, a lot of the kids weren't doing their homework and were failing because of that. Now you take that away, now that teacher is not a failing teacher. That's not held against her. You know, she's not giving out the homework that they're not doing. So therefore, that won't go against her bad grade as a teacher. I think that could be one of the reasons as well.
Could be.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to make a quick or piggyback off of that, because I know when I, you know, when most of us was in school, it was a heavy emphasis on homework. And even if you were in AP courses, I know, you know, you had a lot of homework, but I did note that a lot of my AP teachers put the ball in our court and making us responsible and taking notes, creating our own study notes, as well as, you know, making sure like we were able to comprehend what was being taught. And I think that's key too, in how they go about doing education. It's basically making the kids more, or in their eyes, they're basically saying that, well, it puts the accountability, it switches it from the white females to the children. So that way, when, you know, they do these studies 10 or 15 years down the line, they say, oh, well, you know, if they would have had the, you know, wherewithal to make their notes or study or this, that, and the other, you know, maybe they would have been able to do such and such. It's, you know, like I said, like kind of like a bait and switch, because really, you know, it just, like you said, it allows these teachers to not have to worry about really studying whether or not these children are meeting the different competencies of, you know, what they're learning. Are they learning it, or are they just learning to regurgitate something? Like, are they really comprehending whatever they're being taught? So.
Appreciate that from Princess as well. Last 15 minutes or so in the program, so please do not wait till the last minute. If you think you have commentary you want to share, if you're a parent, you want to give commentary on the homework piece or anything else that we've touched upon this evening, go ahead, speak now. Do not wait till the last few minutes to speak. Anybody that we missed completely have a hand up that had commentary? Anybody who has not been able to speak at all? We got everybody who has had a hand up. Okay. Any other folks who had commentary they wanted to make sure they got in?
Hey, Gus, I have a theory now. In the charter schools in New York where my kids attend, they have to read 60, I think my daughter's in high school, she has to do 80 books. Be able to take an ELA test, which is pretty much like a test with like 5 or 6 questions based on the book that you wouldn't have knowledge unless you read the whole book, to prove that they read it, and they get graded on that test, and that's how they move up to the next reading level. My son, although he's the youngest of them, he's already 12th grade reading level in the 7th grade, so he doesn't no longer have to participate in the ELA program. Because he's already done all his, met all his qualifications. Now, at the same time that they're forcing all this reading on the charter schools, they're taking it out of the public schools. And if Betty DeVos, who's a big-time advocate of charter teaching, I think what they're trying to do is make the charter schools' grades so much better than the public schools' grades that the public has no problem doing away with the public school system. And therefore, they can just move into this private charter school system. And once they do that, of course, the qualifications in charter is going to go down dramatically. But right now, they're pushing these kids because that's one of the huge things. My wife definitely always on the phone. You know, you guys are pushing them too much. It's just so petty with some of the things they call about and the kids are getting in trouble for that we've even decided we might not put our kids, my twins, into a charter high school, you know, at least the same system of charter that they're in, because it's just so petty. However, if the public schools aren't getting that same reading and they're not doing the same work, how are they going to score the same on the state testing? In the charter, the public schools did terrible on the state testing here in New York last year, and the charter schools did very well. And those that didn't do well, they closed down, and those were mostly the black-ran charter schools. But the white ran charter schools are pushing and advocating for all this this reading, all of this technical work where you don't get to help your kids with the homework. Everything's done in a computer, so they're able to control the grading and everything. And I think it's for that purpose, to shut down the public school and have the people who send their kids to public schools and depend on the public school system totally for a total charter system. And I'm at my line. Thank you.
Just to echo the point that I made earlier, even back when the news clips were playing, about how as the number of black people increases, whites become disgusted about, you know, having effective services like healthcare, public education, public transportation. I think with public schools, I think, unless I've been misinformed, there are already more non-white children in public schools than white children. I think that is going to, and I've been saying this for a while, I think that is going to strongly influence whites' thinking, and probably already has. Whites, you know, they tend to be very forward thinking. I'm sure that they saw that this was going to be a problem way, way earlier, years, decades earlier. So I think that could be and could have been influencing the thinking about public education for years, this whole drive. I think Dr. Umar has been talking about this, the erosion of public schools with charter schools and funding. And even they talked about it in the clip, spending less per student in North Carolina. They were talking about that. So the homework thing could be a part of that. I think for most of my life, I've heard people saying, you know, bemoaning the quality of public education in the United States. Giving out less homework does not seem to be the way you would correct that problem, particularly if we're talking about black students, when every other day they're talking about disparities in education, to then say, well, let's just have no homework to close that deficit. That doesn't seem logical to me. We have other folks have commentary they wanted to get in. Did we miss anybody? Everybody? We got everybody who had commentary they wanted to share?
Last thing, Gus, very last thing. LaVar Bell, Cowbell. Cowbell. Every time you hear that name, he's married to a white woman who's dying from cancer. I think that's huge.
Wow. The that piece on the maternal mortality rate, I thought, was extremely important. That has a tremendous impact on black females, the war of racism, white supremacy. And I guess that's maybe something else that should be discussed. I mean, if we people that spend a lot of time talking about Area 8 and black male, black female relationships, maybe that's something that should be discussed. If that much death and trauma is happening with the childbirth process for black females and black children in this part of the world, then, hey, we need to have, you know, serious dialogue. And do we want to do a natural birth process so we can avoid all that and, you know, breastfeeding and all of that? But I mean, serious conversation about that before you even get to the bedroom for people that, you know, endorse Mr. Fuller's concept of having 200 questions. Maybe that should be a part of the conversation before things get too, you know, rowdy in the bedroom. Folks satisfied? Anything else they need to make sure they get in before we're all good?
Gus, I did think of one. It was on my brain. I just didn't know how to articulate it, but it was a reference to, I know that where I am, it's been a huge impact. Of testing has literally become, it's just all about testing. Area of education, that testing is very important. And a lot of teachers, you know, they would complain that they're doing a whole lot of testing. But what I'm seeing is that it's giving non-white kids, do, you know, from I can even see my son's middle school, they do not perform well on these tests. And if you're going to a test-based module, you're literally going to have a bunch of non-white kids that are not performing, increases in suspensions and things of that nature. Still continue to say that we're going to have problems in school and we need more educators. You know, I think I mentioned this maybe a year ago, but I went to a education day at my son's school, and literally I'd say if there were 400 teachers that came out there, 380 were white females, literally. And there's a huge push. They're still getting hired, and I just think it's going to be a benefit for them to maybe the qualifications are a little bit less. You can come in and be a teacher. You're not giving them enough homework, and we're still going to be able to discipline and keep these Negroes and these Latin kids, and they're not going to be performing, and we've got to have more people for them. But in the area of testing, I can see that's a huge benefit because literally they don't give homework. They just say we got to prepare for a test, and it just gives a lot of 21-year-old non-qualified white women a lot of jobs that they really shouldn't have.
Dr. Cambon might refer to that as another form of white welfare. If I heard correctly, you said it was 400 teachers came and that roughly 380 of them were white women. That would be 95% white women. at this event, if those numbers are accurate. Again, that's the sort of thing that I think should be front center when we discuss what they call the school-to-prison pipeline or any other problems with education. We are specifically talking about the domain of white women. No contest. Any other commentary folks needed to get in before we're all done? I did want to say about Dr. Curry, that segment, the abuse, the terrorism that he's being subjected to. It was not this podcast. He's been a guest here numerous times, but it was not us. It was a podcast segment that he did on Rob Redding's program in 2012, where he was talking about the movie Django Unchained. And he was talking about the segment where they were talking about black people committing violence against white people. Leonardo DiCaprio's character in the movie has that scene where he's talking about that. So they dug this up from 5 years ago, his commentary, to, you know, take it out of context and, you know, threaten him with being lynched and killed and everything else. I hope he's able to come on the program at some point to kind of share how Texas A&M has supported him through all this, if they have offered counseling or anything else to make sure that he's doing well, especially, you know, given all the threats and everything that he has received, and how he's talked about this with his family, because I know he has children. So, I mean, I think I brought this point up previously, that if you are a black person, male, female, child, and you work against racism, it could have an impact. It likely will have a direct impact on the people that you care most about, because racists, they tend to say, hey, you know, we will not only retaliate against you, we'll make sure we get, if you, you know, are married or if you have offspring or parents, siblings, friends that you care about, we'll make sure that we go after them, too, as a form of punishment for trying to disrupt our system. But hopefully we'll get to hear more details. And yeah, take it seriously. That's, I talk about that all the time. Take it seriously when we're talking about racism, white supremacy. Speak as if the whole world is hearing what you're going to say. You're comfortable with that and the ramifications of it, because so many people have been killed, attacked, threatened, terrorized just for talking about racism. I say that all the time. Anything else? Are folks satisfied?
About the child mortality, the infant mortality piece, I'm working in a hospital, and when I do labor and delivery, which is where people have the babies, since I worked here, and I do it maybe twice a week, so I get to see all the kids, it's only been two whites full-fledged. It was a few whites that had babies with non-white men, but two white women who's had a baby in this hospital in a city that has a huge white population. So either they're not having kids or they're just not having them here. But it's, I just found it very compelling that they're not having babies. I have Filipinos in there. You see the Asians. You see the Latinos, blacks, of course. But you don't see any whites.
Red.
I just wanted to add one last thing. Just about what you were saying about Dr. Curry, I did actually read through everything that he said, and also it seems like as far as from the university standpoint, I read the letter that the president wrote, and it seemed like it really was speaking to the parents of white students and also the white students themselves, because it seemed like he kept referencing, well, this is not a part of our principles, our core values. I feel like that was definitely some of the verbiage that he used, that the president himself used. And at least on a good note, Amazon, they do have Dr. Curry's book available for pre-order. So I am excited. So once it does ship, I'll be able to get it. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Awesome. I was thinking about that, too, that at minimum, maybe he could use this for free advertising for the new book, The Man Knot, should be coming out this summer. Everyone satisfied?
Oh, yes. Girls, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Just really quick, I forgot to make a mention about there's this 10-year-old black male student. Up in Chelsea, Alabama. He was talking about he's been the victim of racism. And there's this, I believe this poem, the racist poem, one of his so-called classmates said to him, and if I could read it really quick, it says, "Roses are red, violets are blue. I am white, you should be too. Roses are red, violets are blue. I am white, why aren't you? Roses are red, violets are blue. God made me pretty, what happened to you?" So he said, like, the children been chanting this to him in the classroom, and he's only 10 years old. So as you said, racist child, that's very accurate. And that's all I have.
Mm. Young white terrorists in action. Mm. They are not ignorant about racism. That piece of verbiage earlier, I think, that you shared, systematic racism, and people, no one understands what that is. Hogwash. Those little 10-year-old terrorists, they understand exactly what systematic racism is. And it sounds like from they're very closely, very close to the cradle, and it sounds like they are already doing their part to uphold the system of white supremacy standard, and very, very common. You see those type, or at least I see those type of reports on a weekly basis. If you're checking the news just here in the United States, that is very, very common. Racist man, racist woman, racist child. With that, we'll be here tomorrow. Global Sunday Talk on Racism, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. We should have lots of our listeners from various parts around the globe. We will give our international views, perspective on white supremacy. Pam should be with us this coming Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Looking forward to hearing from her as well. Thanks to all the folks who tuned in this evening. I hope it has been a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. If you have a problem, question, guest suggestion, you can't find something in the archive, just drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. With that, I will again encourage sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I know it's close to summertime. You want to go out. I'm sure we even got some folks who might be graduating or have people that they care about that are graduating. Spectacular. Congratulations. You do not, while you are out celebrating, you do not want to put yourself in a potential harm's way by being under the influence while the system of white terrorism is operating. Racists do not cease their activities just because it is a sunny day. There's a lot of evidence that black people being under the influence, that's cigarettes, alcohol, cannabis, whatever it is, that being under the influence of these substances, poisons, it has not helped us replace white supremacy with justice. And often it has made it much, much easier for race soldiers like Betty Shelby, still got her job with the police department, as I understand it. Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, it makes it way easy for them to terrorize and abuse us, do whatever they want. Oh, nigger smelled like he had a drink or was acting like he was under the influence, PCP, crack, so we had to shoot him, you know, 80 times. Sobriety would be best. It is not going to help us neutralize a racist man, racist woman at all. And that is whites with or without a badge. They're dangerous. You want to be sober so you can use your full functioning brain computer to solve problems. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest level of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim. Man.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.